David Orr, stand-up comedian Artie Lang, and live music from the Chicago band The Kickback. Now, here's your host, a man who has never had a facelift that bleeds, Justin Kaufman.
I've had plenty. I mean, geez, if you've seen me in public, I've had least, I mean, I want to give away my secrets, but at least 50. Never bled. Never. So. I get it. The key is sun and golf courses. So I know what Mika was doing. You know, I get it. That's the key. What a day. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. Wow, we got a great show lined up tonight. I'm so excited. I mean, we have politics. We have education. We have comedy. We have live music. And we have terrible films. It's a pretty good combo, right? I mean, we've got it all tonight. We're going to talk in the 7 o'clock hour about what it takes to train teachers. This is interesting. This is the idea of one goal. This is about training teachers to help low-income students not just make it to college, because there's always this talk, and we've seen it here in the city of Chicago as well, just this idea of what it takes to get into college, but to finish college. Because there's a monster drop-off when it comes to low-income students. When they start school, they get to school, and they rarely finish college. And this is where one goal comes in. So we're going to talk about what it takes to bridge the divide between high income, low income. It's something that's been talking about in Springfield when it comes to schools. And we're going to talk about it tonight on the download. Coming up at 8 o'clock, David Orr is going to join us. The Cook County clerk just announced that he is not seeking re-election for the office, and he is going to hang it up after almost 40 years in Chicago politics. David Orr, my guest tonight at the big table. Very excited to talk with him, as Roe was just pointing out, about the death of Harold Washington, about his life in the clerk's office, dealing with voting and voting issues, but also just about what it takes to be in that field. You know, this is an exit interview, so hopefully open up a little bit and talk about what it takes to be a politician, especially in the state of Illinois. We'll talk with David Orr coming up at the 8 o'clock hour. Also tonight, legendary stand-up comedian Artie Lang is going to join us, talk about his career. He's got a show coming up at Thalia Hall on Saturday. Very excited to have Artie Lang on the show. I love Artie Lang. I'm a big fan. Loved him on Howard. Hilarious guy. Read his books. So I'm very excited to talk with him. You know, we're going to get a chance to talk to him. He's actually shooting the show Crashing, season 2. He's got a great part on Crashing, Pete Holmes' show on HBO. So we'll talk with him tonight about stand-up, about character, about being honest on stage. Done it all. Talk Artie Lang coming up on the show. Also tonight, playing a taste of Chicago, the band The Kickback. You heard him here first. Back in 2015, they were on the show. They were one of the first bands that were on Studio 435. And they are going to be playing Taste of Chicago. They're opening up for Passion Pit at the Petrillo on Saturday, July 8th. Before they do that, they're in studio tonight. How great is that? They're going to bring their guitars, talk with The Kickback. Awesome to have them back in studio. Their album's just about to drop. They're the sort of indie rock darlings coming out of Chicago right now, and I'm happy for them. We get a chance to listen to some music, talk to them about their new project they're working on. And then tonight we continue with Justify Your Love for the worst movies of all time. Last week it was Rabbit Test, the Billy Crystal movie where he gets pregnant. And the week before that was Bad Ronald, about a kid who was stuck in the walls of his house and his parents died and no one knew about it. So he just kind of peeked in on the new family. What's this week's? 312-981-7200. We'll talk about the best worst movies. Rachel Claff and Dina Walters in studio. So we got a lot coming up, so let's get to it. News, weather, and traffic tonight. Roger Badish and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got a huge show. Let's start with carryout. Carry Here are today's top stories. What a dignified day in American history, huh? They teach middle school students the day of crazy Mika tweets for days, for years, for decades. The president started the day by going to Twitter to make famous some middling cable TV hosts, but instead of just using the usual sad or losers, he had to go deeper and call a woman crazy and mention her bleeding facelift. Can't wait to see those tweets in the Trump Presidential Library someday. The attack seemed to stir up the internet more than usual, and even Republican lawmakers acted appalled. White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders said that the president is a fighter, and if you come at him, he'll fight right back. Yeah, because you and I both know that the toughest, strongest people are the ones that tweet insults at random cable TV hosts. Right. The argument from the White House is that the president is attacked by these shows all the time, and nobody cares. The White House is acting like there's never been a conservative media and that George W. Bush is universally remembered as a painter. Heck, there was no Twitter for Bill Clinton, but there still feels like there was. Come on, there's nothing less tough than a guy who says he's tough, but then complains about the same stuff that every basic celebrity has to deal with. You want unfair? Go check out Oprah's Twitter. Or how about a football player like Jay Cutler? Or heck, even Hillary Clinton. I mean, come on, man. 20 or so minutes ago, the travel ban is back, although the State Department says there won't be as much chaos at airports as last time. That hasn't stopped attorneys and advocates from racing to the airports tonight, so the truth is they may not have anything to do. I mean, if they're looking for work, maybe litigate how long those sandwiches have been under the heat lamp in the food court. Or approach the bench on what actually is considered a carry-on. You have five purses. That should count for five bags. Judge! So there's still work. There's still leg room. A lot of things you can do at the airport. State Senate Minority Leader Christine Redonia told the world she's resigning from her seat on July 1st. That's Saturday. Jeez, I know the governor threatened to make you work over the holiday, but resign? Maybe she's really into fireworks. No, Redonia's been hitting at this for a couple months now, and today she made it official. So what's it mean? It means a new leader will take over for Republicans in the Senate. Please be Jim Oberweis. Please be Jim Oberweis. I mean, it's just so he can do press conferences from helicopters above Soldier Field while drinking delicious milkshakes. So many people fill this entire stadium. The bummer is that the news of the resignation was the only news to come out of Springfield today. You guys, you have one day left to get a budget together. And now all the legislators, they're just planning a going away party. Maybe Oberweis can offer up an ice cream cake. Still no word on any budget deal. Think about it. We're down to 28 hours left. Plenty of time. And if we hit the first with no budget, we go to junk status. First state in the country to do so. So essentially, the whole state of Illinois will be on the swap meet next week.
Hi. I've got a state. It used to be popular. Unfortunately, it's out of its package. It's kind of rough around the edges. I pulled it out of the garbage bin behind the Geno's East. Is it worth anything?
No, I don't think so. Thanks for calling. A judge is supposed to rule on whether or not to delay a Cook County sugary drink tax. Gee, I hope there's a taste test. That's what I think about. Like the judge is like, I say this one is Pepsi. This one is diet. Yeah, whatever. If I were the lawyer, I'd just say, stop trying to force us to be skinny and drop the mic, right? If it's not about health, then just stop saying that and just tax us. We can take it. We'll take it. In weather, severe weather hit the area last night. Reports of tornado touchdowns in Iowa, Wisconsin, closer to home, flooding all over the northern suburbs, including Rockford. It's never good to have flooding, but worse when it comes right before a holiday. Hard to get excited about the family barbecue when you're shop vac in your basement. In sports, the Cubs came from behind, scored three runs in the ninth inning to split the series with the Nationals. John Jay with the heroics, a double to drive in the go-ahead run. Will this be the kind of game that Trump was talking about, huh? Is this the turnaround? These guys are great, going to be great. He meant the next day, not last night, the next day. They needed this one to send a message to no one. It's June. But good baseball. Baseball we've been missing on the north side all year. Bad news, Chris Bryant out with an ankle injury. I mean, it gets real if a guy like K-Bry goes on the DL, huh? Also, interesting story today about how the games against the Nationals, they weren't sellouts in Washington. Weird, you'd think two popular teams who would probably be in the playoffs would draw. Upon closer look, it's because the Nationals priced this game as, quote, diamond level. Worst ticket in the ballpark went from $12 to $38. And you wonder why you see empty seats every time there's a foul ball down the left field line. It's not that people don't want to come to the ballpark. It's the fact that you triple the price when a good team comes in. Ridiculous. The Sox play the final game of the series against the Yankees tonight, although right now they are delayed. They're hoping to salvage a split. James Shields on the hill tonight. That means either, well, it means one thing. They're going to get 6 runs in 3 innings. If they lose 8 out of their last 10, I mean, come on, it's over. Can we start bringing up the kids now? Here's the deal I'd make at the deadline. Ready? Frazier, Melky, Quintana, Robertson, and that one catcher for whoever are the top two prospects on the Reds, A's, or Astros. I don't know. Whichever team's been the worst in the last 3 years. Just do it all. Throw, like, make all 6 go in one trade. Let's get it over with, and let's start playing guys who are in Charlotte. Do we all agree? I agree. Jimmy Butler was introduced to the Minnesota media today, and then he gave out his cell phone for some dumb reason. Right? Now everybody's got Jimmy Butler's cell phone. When reached for comment, Rajon Rondo was like, that's not the number he gave me. And in WNBA action, how's the train of Elena Deladon doing for the Chicago Sky? They are 3-11 so far this season, and they are winless at the Allstate Arena. Winless at home. Well, it's not their fault. Rebuilding seems to be the thing these days in Chicago sports. They're just being trendy. At least they're in good company. And finally tonight, it's hard to believe that it's only been 10 years since the iPhone was introduced to the public. 10 years? It really feels like it's been 100, right? Seriously, can you imagine a time when we didn't have iPhones? I mean, how many people, how did people check social media? How did people know how to read a map? And how did people sit on the toilet? I mean, happy birthday, iPhone. Thanks for making us better by making things easier. That's the carryout for June 29, 2017. Hey, Chicago restaurants are starting to remove straws from their shops, but not us. You want more than one? I mean, we got boxes and boxes and boxes in the back. All right, coming up, we'll talk about how to get kids not just to start college, but finish. Also, David Orr, he's retiring as Cook County clerk, hanging it up after almost 40 years. Chicago politics, we'll talk about it at the big table. It's a download on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Roger Badish, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing fantastic. I love your show tonight. Great subjects.
I know.
I relate to a lot of
stuff.
Them.
We are right. Good. That's good. I feel like we got a good show tonight. This is going to be an interesting ride. How you been?
I've been fantastic. Yourself?
I'm good. So you're going to be at the 4th of July parade, as you always are.
Yeah, Skokie.
Skokie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How is that parade? Is that a good time?
It's a great parade. It was on the outs for a while, and they brought it back about 3 years ago. And it's just fantastic now. We got.
Do you get to do you get to sit in a cool car, or are you more of a guy in a float?
Actually, I'm the master of ceremonies.
Oh, okay.
So
all right.
I'm at the reviewing stand towards the end, announcing
okay,
all the entries and stuff. But this year we're doing a little something different. I'm going to take a little golf cart at the beginning of the parade, and go through welcoming everyone on the big loudspeaker, and then I'll end up at the end again, and it's going to be fun.
You're kind of
Patty's
like,
going to be out there.
You're like the Fred Willard from Best in Show, right? Hey, take a look at this one. Oh,
now,
look at that.
Look at they have instruments.
Well, that's awesome that you and Patty will be out there. That's
yeah,
awesome.
Yeah, it's my third year doing it. I just have a blast. It's
all
wonderful.
Right. Well, awesome. Well, we got to get out there. Thanks, Roger. It's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 8 o'clock, David Orr is going to join us, the Cook County clerk. He announced last week that he is not seeking re-election for the office, and he is going to retire after 39 years in public service. We'll talk to him about his life in Chicago politics. And you know, the hope is it sort of serves as an exit interview. We've still got a year left at the clerk's office. But the idea of what it takes to be a politician. And understanding the system and government and everything that goes into it, especially in a day when all we want to do is bicker and argue and the divide seems to be getting bigger and bigger. But what does it actually mean to be a politician? What's the job when you're elected to a public office? So David Orr, my guest coming up at the big table tonight, that's after 8 o'clock. Well, tonight, let's talk about schooling and opportunity. A lot has been made about the divide between low-income and high-income students and whether or not the state of Illinois is funding schools appropriately. We've seen that, that political argument's playing out in Springfield even as we speak. But closer to the ground, what does that actually mean? What is pushing the divide between education and educational opportunities for students from different economic backgrounds? And more importantly, what can be done to address it, especially when we're talking about the success of a student post-high school? My guest tonight knows a thing or two about this issue. Sarah Berghorst is the executive director of One Goal Chicago. One Goal is a national organization that's working to bridge the educational divide and works with students to not only get to college, but to stay and finish. Sarah, thanks for being here. Appreciate you coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, this is an issue we talked about, I think it was like maybe 2 weeks ago, about this concept of, you know, it's one thing when the mayor and other leaders want kids to go to college, but it's another to get them to finish college. I mean, is that what we're talking about here? The idea that we need to look at this holistically, that it's not just about getting to college, but it's about the whole picture when it comes to education, making sure everybody gets the best opportunity possible.
Exactly. Actually, that's the reason we named our organization One Goal. And you'll see we have the subtext, which is college graduation, period. It's really not about college access, but persistence and completion, because it's that college degree that allows a 25-year-old access to the middle class, access to agency, to being able to make major life decisions for him or herself.
When we talk about the idea of trying to address the issues of the divide between low-income students and high-income students, what's that about? I mean, when you talk about, let's just first talk about the divide.
Yeah. So to give you a better understanding of that divide, when we look at this across the country, there are about 1 million ninth graders, low-income ninth graders, every single year in our country who begin that journey through high school. If you fast forward about 10 years, less than 200,000 of them have earned a post-secondary degree. Mm. So 800,000 young people are leaving the education
system. They start
system
college.
In between.
Right, right.
They start in high school,
yeah,
but don't
they
end
don't
up
make
completing
it out.
College.
Yeah.
And, you know, in particular, over 70% of those students leave between the 11th grade, so their junior year of high school, and that freshman year of college, which is the reason why we've chosen to really focus in on those three critical years, the final 2 years of high school and the first year of college.
Why do you think that is? I mean, tell me about why the numbers. I mean, this is so staggering when you say it that way and you talk about, you know, 800,000 people. Mm-hmm. Why is it that, that is the age in which, I mean, I can understand choices and bad choices, things of that nature. But what is it about low-income students that are having them drop out at such a significant rate?
That is a big question.
Right.
There are a lot of different factors. I think first and foremost, let's talk about the transition. You know, transitions are really hard for everybody across the country. Between 10 to 40%, as many as 40% of students who already have an acceptance into college, they're planning to go, don't end up walking onto campus that first year of their freshman year in college. And that is sometimes even two times greater for low-income students. We refer to it as the summer melt or the summer flood.
Right.
So these critical summer months are part of this whole journey that begins with academic preparedness. It includes things around mindset, belonging, actual resources in our public schools.
What can you do about that? What can you do about the summer melt? Yep. Let's just stay right there because I want to get into preparedness and the other things you're talking about as well. But I mean, at a certain point, I mean, someone is going to get out of high school. Maybe they're going to graduate and they're going to say, oh, this is great. And, you know, the society has been built on the idea that you are now an adult. You can make your own decision. You can do what you have to do. What can you do as One Goal to continue to steer people on a path towards academic opportunities?
So we think about our supports in three different areas over the summer: the academic, the financial, and the social. And there are things that we're doing in every one of those buckets. So to give you some examples, under academics, we are sending text messages to our students that we call fellows, reminding them of key deadlines during the summer with their upcoming college, making sure that they've checked in, they've sent their final transcript from high school over, they have their new college email, it's sunk up in their phone, and they're ready to go and getting any other notifications as their time draws nearer. On the financial side, they're working on budgets way before they go to school, thinking through how they're going to cover every single cost as it appears, and what their backup plan is. They have a person that they know in the financial aid office, a name, a specific person that they can go to. And then the social, which is really, really important. So we're bringing together our students over the summer so they can meet other students who are going to the same university, build community ahead of time. And also thinking about the family side of the social, it's just as important for you to talk to your family about that transition that you're going through, how available you will be or won't be, and how those family relationships will continue.
Well, a lot of what you do is about graduation. As you mentioned, the subtext on the, even in the site, everything is about college graduation and not as much about access. But when you get to a point where you talk about those three things, academic, financial, and social, just financial, if we're talking about low-income students and the financial picture is messy or it's a puzzle to try and figure out how you're going to go to college, that gets in the way of, I would assume, the other two categories.
Exactly. And you have to begin that preparation early. You know, we begin in junior year with our students thinking through, what are the different types of financial aid? What's the difference between a subsidized loan and an unsubsidized loan? How much debt does it make sense to take out responsibly or not? Those are the types of things that students are starting to think through, work through with their families in their junior year of high school, so that by the time they're getting to college, those are conversations that have been had. And they have a real foundation to work
from. That's smart, because far too often that's the last conversation where you pick where you want to go to school and then it's there and you got accepted and now you have to figure out the financial page package and you're not even thinking about how it's all going to work. The other areas, I mean, let's talk about the, you know, what I find interesting is this notion that this is a lot of this is outside the classroom, obviously. How do you prepare the people who work at One Goal, teachers, other people who are involved, administrators, educators, to work with a low-income community? And how is that different than the way they've been taught, which is a much more generic way?
Yeah, well, let me explain a little bit about how we work. So first of all, the students that we work with come from low-income communities and so have some of the highest financial barriers to college, but also academic barriers, because in particular, we're working with public high school students that come to us on average with sort of a C, a 2.7 GPA halfway through high school. So those are the students that we are working with. At the heart of our model are teachers. So we find teachers that are already in our public schools, and together in partnership with those high schools and those teachers, we deploy those teachers already there to work with the students for 3 years.
Okay.
So they're working with the students every single day of junior year and senior year of high school, and then remotely with that same set of 25 students that they've developed relationships with when those students transition to college. So actually, we're not an after-school program. We are integrated into the school day, reaching okay. students where they are with, you know, some of the most tried and true change agents at the middle of all this, which are incredible teachers.
Right. I mean, that's a source. I mean, if you don't have a teacher who's going to invest in the extra mile it takes to get over the hump when it comes to resources, especially when you're talking about lower income students, all this is for naught, right? I mean, you have to have someone who actually is going to buy in and put social capital in to help low income students get past that threshold.
These teachers become incredible advocates, champions, friends, tough love forces in these young people's lives. And so they're talking not just about the path to college, but about things like mindset. You know, I belong. I can do this. I deserve to get a college degree. There is a lot in our system since the beginning where a lot of these students have heard the message loud and clear that they don't belong, that college is not for them, that they can't do this. And to have an incredible teacher in your life say, hey, like, that's not the story. If you want this, you can have this. And let me help you navigate this roadmap, because it is a roadmap.
Right.
And, you know, there was a recent study that showed that 76% of CPS students desired a college degree. And if you look at the stats today, 18% of CPS students are getting a college degree. So there's a real gap there in what young people want for themselves and what they've been able to achieve. And these teachers bridge that belief gap in
Sarah
very real ways.
Sarah Berghorst is the executive director at One Goal Chicago. We're talking about the goal of not just getting to college, but for students, particularly low-income students, to graduate college. Because there's a big, it was surprising to me as a host and talking to, so I can't remember the guest, it was just this in the last couple of weeks, where that number is so stark. And I mean, you mentioned it all the way to junior year, but the idea that this really was talking about the mayor's plan to say, hey, you have to have a letter of acceptance if you want to graduate Chicago Public Schools. And this guest that we had on was really talking about the idea that, well, that's fine and dandy, and that doesn't seem to be part of the bigger problem. The problem is once these students get into the college environment, they are having harder times adjusting. Let's talk about the academic part, because where are they at when it comes to preparedness? And I know it's such a general, and we're talking generics and broad strokes, especially when we talk about low-income kids. But, you know, kids that are in your program, are they prepared for state school, for the academics of a four-year college?
Most definitely. The students in our program, about 80% of them end up going to a four-year college, and the rest end up going to a two-year college, which is also a great choice. That we really recognize that there are multiple different pathways for students, and as long as they have a clear vision of what it is that they want to achieve and that, you know, this is helping them navigate their way towards that vision, we are very supportive. On the academic side, it's interesting that you note that one of the things we really work with students with in their junior year of high school is improving their GPA, not only their test score, but their GPA, so that they can become a more competitive candidate for college by the time that they are applying. But so many of our students are brilliant, bright, incredible beings. They just haven't focused on the academics. So, you know, the story of a 2.7 GPA is not the story of their potential. It's the story of sort of where they've been to date on academics. And so we have many students that, as part of their One Goal journey, decide to really plug in on the academic side and put a lot of hard work behind it. You know, one of our fellows that I recently was talking to took an extra class during lunch period because we do an exercise with them where we calculate, where's your GPA today? Where do you want it to be? And he realized that in order to make that needle move, he needed an extra class. And so, you know, this is a very real thing. I think as a city, we need to think about all of these students. This is the average student, a B or C student in our school. They are just full of potential and opportunity.
A lot. I mean, I've heard this argument before, and it kind of bubbles up in the argument over school funding and the formula and what's happening in Springfield. But this idea that, you know, we want equitable funding and we want equitable schools across whether regions or areas or communities. But the idea that more often than not, someone who may be in a bracket that's in a high-income community doesn't get an opportunity to get this kind of treatment, meaning to help them shepherd into this transition to finish, to not only start but to finish school, that they're kind of left on their own. And that seems to be an argument I hear over and over, saying that society, we've created these programs that will help a lot of people along the way, but we forget about the people who might be at the B-plus level that don't necessarily get that extra help. When you hear that kind of argument, I hear that enough coming out of Springfield about equitable school funding and school programs. What's your response to that, to the idea that you know, a low-income student is going to get this extra support and get one goal and get an opportunity to make it almost inequitable in the way that another student doesn't?
Wow. I would look at the data. You know, if you look across the United States of America, Illinois is leading the country in terms of inequitable funding. We spend 81 cents on the dollar in terms of our spending on a low-income student versus other students. So we are the ranked last in our country, whereas other states like Ohio are spending, you know, $1.20 on a low-income student versus every other student. So we have so far to go.
Is this where we go? I mean, the idea that you have products and projects that are outside of the schools that integrate and help out to make up for the fact that funding is not there at the government level?
I think it's just one piece of the puzzle. You know, we need to invest in our public universities and colleges. We need to fix the funding formula. And every young person in our city should also have a caring adult in their life that tells them, you know, you can do this. It's normal that you're in the middle of the summer and you're doubting yourself, but I believe in you, and I'm going to help you, and I'm going to be there for you to help you navigate the challenges.
Sarah, my last question tonight is more of an emotional one, in the way that you can tell in your voice, you know, the pride that comes from, and some of the, you talked about the fellow who picked up the class at lunch. How emotional is it when a student who's part of One Goal doesn't finish this out? That says, you know what, yes, I'm involved, but then because of the three things, social, academic, or financial, they disappear, or they don't, or they drop out, or they don't go into college, or they drop out of college. How emotional is this when you're building these connections with the fellows?
Very, very deep for our teachers and for our staff. But very important. You know, we are learning every single day, and it's also important that we don't put forward the narrative that equals failure. You know, there are some new studies out too that even some college has really transformed life outcomes. And so walking this path and having an opportunity to think long and hard about what your personal vision for success is, how you'll navigate there, how you get through challenges, pick yourself up and move on is an important journey, you know, for all people in terms of their self-actualization.
Sarah Berghorst is the executive director at One Goal Chicago, a national organization working to bridge the educational divide, working with students to not only get to college, but to stay and finish. Sarah, thanks for joining me today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, coming up, David Orr. Join us at the big table tonight. Talk about his career as he is not running for re-election as Cook County Clerk. Also later in the show, Artie Lang's going to join us, the stand-up comedian. He's going to be at the Thalia Hall coming up this weekend. Talk with him about his great career. Looking forward to that. And then the band The Kickback will be here. They're open up for Passion Pit, the Taste of Chicago, the Petrillo. Love to have any band that's at Petrillo, just so I can say Petrillo all night. That's the key, right? These guys are playing Petrillo. You got to get a Petrillo. I'm trying to break the Guinness Book of World Records of how many times you can say Petrillo. One show. Kickback coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And then tonight, the Neo-Futurists are back. It came from the Neo-Futurarium, the stage readings of bad movies, the worst of all time. And we will pick a third because we've had two great ones, right? We had Rabbit Test and Bad Ronald, so we need a third tonight. 312-981-7200. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it was announced last week that Cook County Clerk David Orr would not be seeking re-election. Orr has served as a clerk since 1990. In that time, he's championed voter rights, including motor voter, early voting, and just recently a push for automatic voter registration. But his work in the Chicago area goes well beyond voting. He was also supported and passed several ordinances pertaining to human rights, same-sex marriages, and other issues surrounding the gay community. Part of that work started before he was clerk. In fact, David Orr's career began as an alderman back in 1979. That's 38 years of service. And, of course, David Orr has the distinction of serving as Chicago's 43rd mayor. He held the office for 7 days after the death of Harold Washington. Tonight, we talk with the outgoing Cook County clerk about his career in politics. David Orr, welcome to the big table. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Justin.
Tell us. I mean, let's just start right there. What would the
Well, I have to tell you one thing first.
What's that?
One thing first is that I'm probably the only big city mayor that you will ever personally meet that never raised taxes in my entire term.
So, you tried.
Had
just
it been
record,
eight,
you
eight
tried,
days, no. maybe. But
why the decision to step down or not seek re-election for Cook County Clerk?
It's really personal in this sense that I like what I do. I believe in it. I kind of believe in the fight. This is a wonderful time to be taking on the power, more or less, you know, federal, state, county, whatever. But here's the way I look at it, that I'm 72 years old. I've had a lot of fun. But the next term doesn't even start for a year and a half.
Right.
Okay, so you take the year and a half and then you add a four-year term. You know, so you're kind of committing to 5.5 years. And while I like it, there's a lot of other things I'd like to do. So it really boils down to, you know, I like lots of things, and I figured it's probably time that I just move on.
Is that a retirement, or do you say, I just don't want to be clerk anymore, you want to run for something else?
I think it's retirement. I'm enough of a politician that I'll just kind of intentionally leave that out there. Someone ticks me off enough.
You know,
I see myself as a kind of a progressive Democrat, but I get ticked off enough about things that I want to see things change, and I plan to stay active, but time to let somebody else take on the job and have some fun for myself.
Well, let's talk about, you know, specifically, I want to talk about your career in politics, especially at the clerk's office. One of the issues that everybody in Chicago knows you for is the idea of voters' rights. I mean, we've talked a lot. We've talked with you on this program about early voting, about automatic voter registration. How far have we come as a society in the time that you've been in office as the clerk to being more transparent and giving people more opportunity at their right to vote?
Well, it's been good and bad. Now, speaking here particularly in Illinois, okay, because, you know, there's great variance among the states. In Illinois, we've moved Illinois now that we're considered one of the most open states when trying to make easy access to registration and easy access to voting. And everything we've done is based around certain premises that, you know, we should make it easy to vote. We vote on a work day, well, only two major nations in the world that do that, you know, on a Tuesday.
Yeah, right.
Most everybody else votes on a weekend or a holiday. So because, you know, I really believe this. Now, some would say, well, he's just a Democrat, so he wants low-income people to vote. But what I believe is that the more people vote, the better, because we get a real, true, genuine feeling of where the country should be going. And so you don't want to make it, oh, well, you know, it's really hard for me. And so all the things over the last several years, whether it's like motor voter, where we had to sue the governor, yeah. Governor Edgar, back in the 80s, which allowed us to really find better ways to register people at driver's facilities. They were safe. They were cheap. It's worked very well, and probably close to 80% of all registrants are done yeah. that way. And then all these other things, the early voting, which has been a great success. We worked hard on that. And most of the things that we took to Springfield, it took us a few tries. Early right. voting didn't happen the first time.
Right.
The teen judge program didn't happen the first
You're
time.
You're seeing it now with the automatic voter right. registration.
Mail voting, yeah, yeah. Same with automatic voter. So our view was this idea of a voter renaissance. Now, again, that's a lot of good stuff in Illinois. But we've also had the opposite in certain places, and that's voter suppression. And I don't blame all the voter suppression on Republicans. You do see a lot of Republican states pushing that. But in some ways, like the old machine. The old machine would be very clever. The old Democratic yeah. machine here in Chicago and Cook County, you know, they would try and suppress certain votes, too. So it's unfortunately, it's around too much, because the power in government, even though a lot of people don't realize it, they may not care.
Well, they think it doesn't exist, power. But there definitely yeah. is, right?
And the one who knows their power are the more powerful elements, because they understand that. You know, corporations know it, powerful law firms, and they should know it. So because of that, there is these attempts at voter suppression, and I talk about that a lot because I'm very concerned about it. I do believe our democracy is getting dangerously close to being in trouble.
Do we run the risk of puppeting back what we hear in the news or talking points from politicians when we hear about voter suppression? We hear a lot about voter fraud. We hear that we came out of this mm-hmm. 2016 presidential election. Fraud is everywhere. You know, check this out. We need to do a lot with fraud. And then you get down to the nitty-gritty, and you're like, well, there really aren't any cases of actual voter fraud. Do we run the risk of being manipulated by politicians who want to suppress the vote by talking about things that may not actually exist?
Well, absolutely. But let's put it in a kind of constructive way. We run the risk of politicians misleading us on everything. Let's face it. As a politician, you want to be able to vote for the things that everybody loves and hide out from the things that nobody likes.
Right.
And good leaders in politics sometimes, so people say, well, what about Mike Madigan? Well, what a lot of people like about Mike Madigan, that might be a Democrat, is he wants to protect you. Exactly what Jim Durkin wants as Republican side. So the point is, politicians don't want to have to vote for something that's terribly controversial. So the point is, we have to be skeptical, and we need to be educated, and we need to see through certain things. I was really young when I first discovered that I was listening to some state legislator, and they were telling me how much they were in favor of a particular thing. And then I found out later they weren't at all, but they could do that because they were going to vote yes because they knew the state Senate was going to kill it anyway. Again, I don't want to be overly cynical. This is just, it's education.
What happened to the bright-eyed David Orr that we knew so well, the former mayor? No, I'm joking.
Well, no, remember, I taught for a long time, so this wasn't a surprise to me. But it's important. It's not cynical. It's understanding people want to, in most cases, do the right thing. Certainly not all cases, particularly in some Chicago's history. But the point is, we need to be looking for those things so we can be realistic about the assessment. I'll tell you something else, and let me go after both of the Democratic candidate, Mr. Pritzker, and the Republican candidate, Mr. Rauner. Nothing against either one of them. I don't think a democracy can function if billionaires can start spending money, because they have it, a year and a half before an election. It's not happened anywhere that I know of in any democracy in the world. It used to be there'd be a primary in March. People would be cool. The winners would go off, come back after Labor Day. So the problem with these continuous campaigns is largely the money. Mm-hmm. One, because other people can't. Could be some really good candidates, but they're not billionaires. Because we know the power of TV. And also that we have these long campaigns and people wonder what the heck is going on. And what do we do with those long campaigns? We have to raise enormous amounts of money. And how do we spend it? On usually nasty ads.
Let's take a break so we stay on time tonight, because I want to pick up on that, because I do think that we've seen politics change. I mean, we talk about it on the show all the time, just the idea that, yes, we are having big conversations about the gubernatorial race, you know, before even August, when it's supposed to kick off primary season, which is way too early to begin with. David Orr, my guest, the Cook County clerk, who has announced just last week that he is not seeking re-election. Sounds like a retirement, but we won't use that word. But David
okay.
Orr is my guest at the big table tonight. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, in studio, Cook County Clerk David Orr made big news last week saying he wouldn't seek re-election for Cook County Clerk. You know, we're talking about politics. You've been around the game now coming up on 40 years as a progressive Democrat. And what I enjoy about the conversation is that, you know, you can take a stark walk-away look at the way that politics is progressing in this country, in this state, in this county. And it's not Republican-Democrat. It's just the idea that politics. And we talked about right before the break just the idea that it just seems more and more that it is becoming a 24/7, 365-day process to elect any sort of official. It's amazing to me to be down to be talking about in Springfield that we're not going to pass a budget because it's going to have an impact on what happens in 2018. For you, coming up on 40 years in the business here, does that surprise you that we're at this stage?
I'm not sure surprised, because there's reasons for everything. And what I was saying earlier, whether it's voter suppression, whether it's misuse of money in politics, these things have been growing. There's been another key force on this, and that is you've got on one hand you've got kind of a right-wing ideology that government's the enemy. Now, you've heard me criticize government, and we should when government doesn't do the right thing. I can point to things every day out there that disappoint me. But I still believe in it because government is the tool of democracy. So we've got the right-wing ideology that sometimes goes over the top there, and then we've got the old machine mentality, let's say in Chicago and Cook County, where they misuse government, and people see it
right, for
corruption or advantages for some. Those things really hurt us. And what's happened now, 50 years ago, 70-some percent basically thought government did the right thing most of the time. According to Pew, more recently, it's like 19%. So, yes, we have a problem, and having people cynical and not participate helps some more than others. So
people in power,
this is not
right,
accidentally. The more powerful you are, the more you benefit from average people saying the heck with it. They're all crooks or jerks. And the fact is there's lots of great people, even in politics. Politics should be the art of managing conflict. It's not easy to do. And so, but these factors of money and the fact of people with enormous amount of money being in charge. Like, no offense, again, to Mayor Rahm or to Governor Rauner. But there's a fairly good possibility that neither would be in office if they didn't have all that money when they ran for office. So that's something to factor in.
Yeah.
We may not have some of the problems we have if you don't have this new phenomenon now where powerful politicians are raising millions on the side, the mayor, for example, or the governor, and to basically say, now my colleagues, either the Democrats in Chicago or the Republicans downstate, you vote the way I want,
right,
or I will crush
but,
you.
But that can't be new, right? Because well, Mayor Richard J. Daley used to run the Democratic Party.
No, it's new in the sense of big money. Richard Daley had dictatorial powers in Chicago. He had other ways to do it. He could just say, you lose 50 jobs just like that, and you're gone. So we had an old patronage system that's
right,
not completely gone, but it's weaker than it was. And yes, there's always been influence, but this idea of being able to raise $20, $30 million and to say to a state legislator or an alderman, you better or else, it's gotten so much more crass. And so coming back to your main point is we need to find ways to break through that. And like you said before, here in Illinois, we have a governor, at least in my view, it's not that he doesn't care. You see all these things, all these social service agencies, millions of people being affected. But he argues that his, quote, agenda is so important he's worth doing it. And my problem is just that agenda is largely one that says to survive in the future, we have to lower people's salaries. That's the key to it. bus unions. And when you do that, I mean, it's something nice. America grew when you had workers, people that could move from, let's say, a lower working class into a middle class and afford to pay for their mortgage. Those are all wonderful things. But now a lot of people are worried, and I'm not calling them right or left. They're worried, and so the answer is, well, let's cut wages. So increasingly, the good jobs that might have been $35 now, they're fighting for $18, $17, and that has an enormous effect on our government.
Well, as you talk about, I mean, you mentioned the idea of a politician's job. I mean, at the core is to manage conflict. And there's so much conflict around, meaning, you think of all the things that circle around a city like Chicago and people with interests and their own agendas. And it's the mayor's job to make everybody, talk to each other. Almost an impossible job. But we see, in a way, a shift, and it seems to be a paradigm shift in the way that Governor Rauner has decided that that's not his job. He doesn't need to manage the conflict. There's conflict constantly. There's chaos and conflict with no compromise in sight. And Mike Madigan can't be let off the hook as well as another politician who has not managed conflict. What do you say to that? What do you say to the idea that we are seeing a stark difference and almost a move away from that concept that politician's job is to manage conflict?
I always look for the causes of some of these things. And some of the causes are like old machine politics. In Mr. Rauner's case, it's ideology trumps common sense. But also, you go back to the money. No offense to Bruce, but he wouldn't be there without that money. And some other Republican, we had some moderate Republicans, would have been compromising with Madigan, just like Edgar did. And we'd have our problems, but we would not have this state. And if we didn't have the old machine and that iron control, we probably wouldn't have a Mike Madigan. And we might have a more, how can you put it, more flexible Democratic leader that was concerned about the whole Democratic Party and not just what you might call those powerful influences in Chicago and Cook.
So campaign finance and patronage seem to be, this is the terrible marriage that has come together to rule the state of Illinois.
And we're trying to break away. There are some improvements. I was talking about this all through Mayor Daley, the young Mayor Daley's term when the media largely said that was all over, right? They talked to me in the 1990s, Patch is dead. And I said, what are you talking about? And then the big scandal broke in 2003 or 2004, and several of the mayor's top people went to jail for fixing the tests and so forth.
Yeah, right.
It's kind of easy to beat the game. So Chicago and Cook County, Chicago's now out from under Shackman. Let's hope it's a good thing. It's hard to say yet. But as they're out from under that, these things don't work by laws alone. Democracies work, or think of a small town. Things work not because of a law, because people respect it, general respect. The child who's a little bit off, people make fun of them, they still take care of the person. In the big city, you've got all this anonymity, and it takes different kind of solutions.
Yeah.
So part of the problem is, yes, we've had bad politics. The power of the machine just alone has caused enormous problems for Chicagoans today, because the major issue in my mind is still race. And if you look at society in a larger sense and you see what's happened with particularly African Americans that come to policing, housing, schools, et cetera, it's an enormously serious problem. And the decades of machine rule, I think, aggravated that. So we're trying to break some of that stuff down. We've got some great leaders, which is really important. Okay, you see some really wonderful leaders, particularly like in the African American community, not always at the elected official level, but I think people to the schools, even the teachers' union, even Black Lives Matter, there's some of the union. There's a lot of really talented African Americans. It gets harder when you move into politics because of the money.
Mm-hmm.
The money, and it's much easier for whites, for example, to raise money, white politicians like me, than it is for African Americans to raise money. And so what does that mean? It means that they're more dependent upon certain lobbyists. No offense again. I guess I'm offending a lot of people, but no offense to People's Gas and Commonwealth Edison and so forth, but it's much easier to win votes from those who can't raise much money. You go to any state legislator's political party, and they're all there. I'm just talking about the real world of politics and what we have to overcome.
Yeah.
So what we really want is simple, that the public votes, not as long as, as long as it's a fair vote, their vote, and as long as minority rights are protected, the majority should be listened to. And that is being drowned out by the role of money and some of these other things I'm talking about.
David Orr, Cook County Clerk in studio. He just announced last week he will not be seeking re-election, retiring from politics after 30 39 years. When we come back, let's take a break for the news. When we come back, we have to talk about your term, your 7-day term as mayor of Chicago. David Orr, my guest in studio tonight. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio tonight at the big table, Cook County Clerk David Orr. David Orr announced last week that he would not be seeking re-election, and it sounds like a retirement from public service. David Orr, long 38 years of service, including a stint. I say stint. A seven-day stint as the mayor of Chicago after Harold Washington died. Take us there. Take us to that moment. We know so much about that. We've had a good job of being able to understand that history. But from your vantage point, being in that position when a mayor dies and having to be in the middle of a political, I don't even know what you would call that, everyone just jockeying for position and for the seats. What was that? Tell us about that.
It's probably the wildest political time I've ever experienced. Let's set the scene. Most people didn't understand what was going on. First of all, I was Harold's vice mayor, and that was a new position. So earlier when the old man Daley died in 76, there was no secession policy, and a lot of black Chicagoans were upset because Wilson Frost didn't get to be mayor. They thought he was in line, and instead the 11th Ward pulled off Blandick.
Right.
And so part of the compromise at the time was to go to Springfield and create the vice mayor post. But and I, it's probably Ed Burke, and I give Ed Burke for his cleverness, not a lot of other things, but for his cleverness. And the way it was written, though, was starting in the early 80s, there would be a vice mayor in case the mayor died or was incapacitated. But that mayor would only serve until the city council picked a replacement. So that was the key, which I knew, and the press was learning right away. So we had the tragedy, and for me it was highly personal because I admired Harold. We were close. I thought there was great things that were happening. I thought there was a good future for him and the city. And then, of course, you had this people, how did this guy die? Was he poisoned? Thousands and thousands believed there was something happened. And we had 30,000, 40,000 people in the street. So during that week, I was involved in a lot of honorary things. I remember, for example, you know, we had his body laid out in City Hall, and the crowds were so enormous. We had to chalk things on the sideway for blocks and blocks. And for several weeks after that, I would walk that and watch as the chalk would gradually disappear. And it took several weeks before all the chalk was gone. So part of it was honorary stuff, and then it was really hardball politics. Because before the mayor officially died, people were discussing, again, Ed Burke, he must have found out through his police buddies or whatever, exactly what was going on, so they knew how serious the condition was, and people started plotting. And I got nothing wrong with people plotting. At the time, I basically said, remember, I'm this little white guy in a city that had really had this respected black mayor, and so I thought it was very important that I be calm, that I have African-American leaders with me when I spoke as much as possible, talk about transition, and I promised I wouldn't pull any tricks. And people asked me whether I would be a candidate for mayor, and I said, I'm not going to consider any ideas like that before we've properly buried the mayor. So all the stuff went on, a lot of things that some have been written about, some haven't.
Yeah, right.
One of the most fascinating was is when it came down, you know, a lot of things happened that were changed. Several African Americans were originally going to go along with the Vidoliak, ironically, was gone by this time. But the 29, the white majority,
led largely
by, you know, Ed Burke and Dick Mell and some others. And originally several African-Americans were going to work with them, and then they had pulled off because people in the streets and became a real battle. And I know security came to me at that time before the big meeting was supposed to start on the Monday night after Harold died on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, because they're really concerned that among the thousands in the streets would be gangbangers in trouble. And so it was an attempt maybe to see if we could postpone that meeting. And that was a fascinating discussion because I was going back and forth and meeting with Eugene Sawyer, who became mayor, and Tim Evans, the floor leader that was hoping to be mayor. So a lot of fascinating things. It was entertaining given I was roundly, I don't want to say disliked, but that's probably true, by a majority of my colleagues on the other side. And so all of a sudden I'm mayor, and I just got a kick out of some of the people seeking help at the time.
That's amazing history. I mean, it's Chicago history that, like you said, it's been well documented, but there still has to be stories that have been untold. As you think about those days.
I got one.
That's where I was going.
I got one for you. I don't think this one's been told. People that know our little political history, no on that famous night, which I call the world's longest political slumber party, when the meeting was supposed to start at 4 or 5 in the afternoon, didn't complete till 4 in the morning when Gene Sawyer was finally voted in. We all know that Dick Mell, the colorful Dick Mell, stood on the desk.
Of course. Yeah.
Okay, and he stood on the desk and he basically shouted at me because I wasn't recognizing his side. And there was truth to that. And I made a very conscious decision because I knew, well, I felt certain laws were being broken, but I couldn't do much about it. But I knew if I called on one of the majority, they would move to close things down and there'd be no debate. And that's not a good way to do it. So I let the minority have their say. And then we moved ahead. But I don't think that's a real reason Dick Mell was standing on the table. And here's what you've got to remember, because Dick Mell was always ahead of the game. Okay, remember a guy named Blagojevich. What Dick Mell was thinking, okay, fine, they're going to elect a new mayor that night. But also, what did you have? You had David Orr as vice mayor. You had Larry Bloom. You had Tim Evans. You had all of us that had committees. Now, the lifeline to most aldermen and most politicians in Chicago is, we want those committees. That's where the jobs are. Some of them have 20, 30 jobs. So Dick Mell was really, in my view, on the table because he wanted to embarrass me and hoped that they could convince Gene Sawyer to kick us all out. Now, it did take Sawyer. This was, remember, November when he was elected. And I was the first one to go, but that was for several months. I don't know if it was February or March before the majority, in this case, Mel and the others were able to convince Sawyer, you know what, get rid of these guys. The same day I introduced an ordinance to restrict the way aldermen, they had these slush funds, and I had introduced an ordinance how that should be regulated. And the same day,
very popular.
That's the day I got canned as vice mayor. And so then they brought in other people. And so gradually all of us were ousted. So there's a lot of things behind the scenes because, remember, politicians often, they're looking to what their interest is. I wish more of them were looking at how do we fix the schools and how do we fight crime successfully. But a lot of them look toward what's the particular advantage to them and how do they shape it weeks ahead of time, months ahead of time.
Final question, and it really is just about, are you going to miss it? You're stepping down as clerk. You talk about these stories. I mean, it's been a part of your life for 40 years. I mean, are you going to miss being a public servant for Cook County and for the city of Chicago?
Well, I'm sure I'll miss some things. But I've when I left teaching in 1979, I didn't look back. When I left the city council in 1990, I didn't look back. So I'll miss certain things. But remember, I don't plan to go away. I'm not in a coffin or anything that at least I know of. So I plan to raise a lot of hell, even while I'm still clerk. And I'm going to continue to speak out. So answer your question is, I will miss some things. I'll probably miss the fact that the media won't care what I have to say. But the fact is I will stay active. But, you know, there's a lot of fun things in life.
We care. We'll have you back.
Well, thank you.
You have to come back and tell more stories of your time. And also, you know, talk to us about what we should really be paying attention to when it comes to Cook County, state, even national, international politics. David Orr, the Cook County clerk who will not be seeking re-election in 2018, retiring from public service. Clerk Orr, thank you so much for being my guest tonight at the Big Table.
My pleasure.
It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is coming to Thalia Hall this Saturday night. Artie Lang is bringing his hilarious stand-up to Chicago. Lang made he's made us laugh for years on stages all around the country in television shows like Mad TV, films like Dirty Work, Beer League. Lang's well known for his work on the Howard Stern Show, where he was co-host till 2009. Now, Lang is starring in the HBO hit Crashing, which is shooting season 2. And, of course, his podcast on ArtieQuitter.com. He just finished his 400th episode. Artie has had quite a life, from his days as a longshoreman in Jersey to a couple stints in rehab for drugs and alcohol to attempts to take his own life. And what's amazing is that we don't learn about these stories from the gossip pages or from the police blotters. No, Artie's been upfront. He's honest and real about his life. He's written two books, Too Fat to Fish, one of my favorites, and Crash and Burn, the latter dealing with the issues mentioned above. Like I said, Artie Lang will be performing at Thalia Hall this weekend, and he is my guest right now on the download. Artie Lang, thanks for coming in. I appreciate you taking some time out to talk to us tonight.
Oh, wow, man. That was I don't know whether to cry, laugh, or whatever, but that was a hell of an intro.
All right, so
that was really looking back.
You know, for you, I'm a big fan of yours, man. I've been a longtime listener, and like I said, read the books. You know, you've come through Chicago a lot in your stand-up career. I mean, what are some of the memories that stick out about playing this town?
Chicago. You know, the first time I played Chicago was February. And that's the last time I was ever in Chicago in February. I was dating this girl, this petite little Italian girl from North Jersey. And I never saw anything like this. I was trying to impress her, so I was playing Zanies, you know. So I got a room at the Four Seasons to impress the girl, which means I broke even for the weekend. And we were walking by Lake Michigan to try to go get something to eat. And I never saw this before in my life. Because of the wind, they had ropes. You know, they have the ropes on the side of the building for old people to hang on to in case they, to make sure they don't get blown away. And we were the only two people under 40 holding on to the rope.
There you go.
And, I was on the rope, and she was on me. And I said, I just want Oprah doesn't come blowing by and kill us both.
Well,
I went to Zany's that night, and we went out to a blues club, and I almost got arrested trying to buy coke by where John Dillinger was shot.
So you did all the Chicago things then. You did all the Chicago things. Well, I mean, let's talk about Crashing before we get into the show. I mean, you are great on Pete Holmes' Crashing, and you know, it's really a show about stand-up comedians coming up. It's obviously about Pete, but also about, you know, finding your comedy crew. And that's really what Pete's doing, is he's trying to find out, you know, comics around him and sort of, you know, explore the camaraderie. For you as a stand-up, do you relate to that? Do you relate to the show in the way that, you know, it's all about coming up through the business, but also about finding your friends?
Yeah. The show Crashing is very accurate in a lot of ways, but what Pete does is shows just the nice guys that you meet, and it's a very small percentage. The fact that he breaks me down and I let him sleep on my couch, and he's just some guy. I mean, you know, he looks like John Voight in the movie with Ratso Rizzo. I don't think I would ever. It would take years before I'd let him sleep on my couch. Put it that way. I don't care if he was homeless. If I walked by him and he had bugs coming out of his eyes, I would still go, "No, how's it going? Everything all right?" I don't think you find a lot of guys that trustworthy immediately. Even though and I tell you, you don't find a lot of guys with the chops Pete has to ask immediately like that.
Yeah, right.
But they definitely are out there, and relationships like that do exist, where older guys help younger guys. I'm not a guy who helps younger guys.
Well, for you, Artie, I mean, you play the character of Artie Lang in the show. I mean, and we know that character, but how much of it is a character? I mean, just in your life as a stand-up, getting on stage, I mean, you have succeeded in the way that you've been, like, honest and real about your life. But how much of it is a character that you're playing on an HBO show?
Well, listen, Judd did this brilliant thing of that pizzeria scene. He just said that there was a script, but it was very loose. And at that point, I was still playing kind of a guy that wasn't totally me. And I don't think Judd wanted that. I don't know if Pete wanted that either, but Pete expected us to do the script. So before that scene, Judd said, "Listen, forget the script completely." And I'm like, "Okay." And he goes, "This is gonna be." I didn't even know at that point that the pilot was gonna be named Artie Lang. At that point, I didn't know that. And he said, "He goes, I really want this to be about you." And Judd read both of my books, and he said, "Just tell Pete about your life for the first take." And he had four cameras rolling, which is an advantage of being a powerful guy like that with a lot, big budget. 35mm film and four cameras rolling the entire time. And he said, "Just tell Pete about what it takes to get here, and then what it takes to be someone like you who screws up along the way as a cautionary tale." And I did, and 15 minutes later, the judge said cut, and we moved on. We did the entire scene in that take.
That's amazing. And it's so real.
He said, "We got enough." And I said, "Well, it's good. Now it's about me, you know."
You know, I mean, that's what has always set you apart and the project that you've worked on, but you've had this ability to be honest on stage. I mean, is that something you have to learn, you know, through being a comedian at the beginning? Were you less interested in telling people about your story or who you were? As you got older, did it just sort of that became your act in the way that you are able to be honest on stage and you have to be because of everything that's happened to you?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, you know, David Letterman, I know, once said in an interview, he said, no man is really funny until they're like 35. Because you've experienced life and you get a certain amount of cynicism and all that stuff. I mean, there's people like Eddie Murphy who were so insanely talented with impressions and stuff like that. And Chappelle, I mean, I was, in town when Chappelle came up, and he just had this very unique worldly sense about stuff. But mostly, you got to experience life to be funny, you know. And it hit me, what you're talking about hit me around 28, 29, when I had done a lot of screwing up and had a lot of tragedy that was both my fault and not my fault happened in my life, to where I said on stage one night, you know, I'll just talk about, you know, the guards and how they treated me at L.A. County when I got arrested. And I did this in L.A. and it destroyed. I guess a lot of people in that crowd had been to L.A. County. Being handcuffed to this one kid for 6 hours while I was getting processed and all this stuff. And, you know, it just flowed out of me. That night I went back to the hotel and I really punched it up. I added jokes to the story. And I couldn't do anything different than that from then on, yeah. You know.
You know, it's just interesting because you've lived such a rock and roll lifestyle with all the comedy you've done, but also the excess that's been in your life that you've written about and you've been upfront about. You know, is there something about the business, the business of being in comedy that sort of attracts addiction, codependency, the excess? Talk about that. Talk about the idea. Would you be someone who had the same problems in your life if you were working behind a desk in a cubicle, being an accountant?
Well, it's funny, you know, people say, I was never going to be an office guy because I didn't go to college. That wasn't my style, but I was a longshoreman on the port in Newark for 2 years in the times I would have been in college struggling. And that's not a job you find in the paper, you know. It was a great job. I worked with a lot of characters, and I got some stand-up from that. People say, if you stayed there, you probably wouldn't have had the drug issues. And to me, that was my version of a cubicle, like the longshoreman thing. I would have been worse. I would, because I wouldn't have been doing what I loved. I got this dream job, and I still wanted to get high. And both ways. Like if I had a miserable night on stage and bombed, I wanted to get messed up because it was a way to get the blues away. And if I had a great night, it was a way to celebrate. If I wasn't doing that dream job, and like what you're talking about, had the cubicle thing, yeah. I would have been way worse because it always would have been bad. It never would have been good or anything. And I would have self-medicated on that level in a way I more so than I do now. You know,
you've had an amazing run with your podcast. I mean, 400 episodes. Congratulations on that. And I mean, and the work that you've done to be, you know, both in podcasts, but also in radio with Howard, you know, to be a part of that crew and to think about the amount of the legends that have come through that show, Howard Show, other places, what's it mean to you to, even though, you know, you've had your ups and downs with the relationships, what's it mean to be a part of, to be a part of that family, to be a part of, the network that really has done better than so many other media entities in the entire world.
Right. Yeah, well, listen, I mean, you know, it's really nice to have a guy, you know, in your position, a real successful GN and stuff, say something like that. A lot of guys don't admit that out loud. That, you know, Howard, when he left for Satellite, when we left, it was a real, real gut changer for radio.
Yeah.
I mean, he was that powerful and that big, and to be a part of that was insane. For me personally, it was like becoming a U.S. senator. I mean, the neighborhood I came from. And my father turned me on to the show. I was 13 years old in the summer of 82, and he came home from working, and he was, you know, he climbed roofs, and he said, "Tomorrow you're coming to work with me, and I just want you to hear this guy on the radio." And it was a bonding thing. I worked with him that whole summer, helping him install the antennas, and we ate lunch listening to Howard. And me and my father laughed like crazy together at that. Besides baseball, Stern was, in a way, the thing we bonded on the most. My father fell and became a quadriplegic when I was 18. He fell off a roof. The only thing that made him laugh was Howard. You know, so when he came back from rehab, I made sure he had a radio right there. And so if he, when he died, when I was 22, I was basically just a drunk going from loser job to loser job, getting arrested. And I don't know what was going on in his head about the future of his kid, but it must have been bad. If I'm telling you, if there is a way for an afterlife,
yeah.
And he knows that I became the co-host of the Howard Stern Show, I got to tell you, Justin, he's going to go crazy.
I mean, that's amazing.
I got some stuff to tell you, man.
Exactly. Well, Artie Lang is going to be at Thalia Hall this weekend on the first down at Thalia Hall. It's amazing to talk to you. Thanks so much for taking some time out. Again, go see Artie. It's awesome when he comes through Chicago. And continued success with your stand-up as well as your role in Crashing and, of course, your podcast. Artie Lang, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Justin. Those were real heartfelt questions. I appreciate it, man.
All right. It's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour tonight, the curators of the It Came from the Neo Futurarium Film Festival, stage readings of the worst movies of all time. We'll talk about what the worst movies of all time are. There's some stiff competition. The first 2 weeks, it was a movie called Bad Ronald, which is about a kid who lives in the walls of a house. Parents forget about him. And then the second last week was Rabbit Test, which was a Billy Crystal vehicle in the late 70s where he gets pregnant. And it was supposed to be a comedy, and it didn't really turn out that way. So those were the two winners from the last 2 weeks. If you got one that can top those, 312-981-7200, do that in the 10 o'clock hour. Tonight, we give you a pre-holiday treat as the Chicago band The Kickback are in studio. The Kickback are just about to release a brand new album called Weddings and Funerals. It's coming out in mid-July since the last time we heard from these guys here on the show 2 years ago. They are killing it. Take a listen to the new single, Will T.
I still have to you today and probably tell you a lie. And be something that you always wanted to hear if I said hi to you today. If you and I went out tonight, it'd be a disaster for sure. You'd wake up by me and feel so stupid if you and I went out tonight.
Love it. Will T by the band, The Kickback, their new record, produced by Dennis Herring, the man who produced Modest Mouse, Counting Crows, Elvis Costello, and others. The Kickback are going to be on stage next week, July 8th, at the Taste of Chicago. They're going to be opening up for Passion Pit at the Petrillo. How many times I get to say it? It's my pleasure to welcome back in studio The Kickback, Billy Yost, Johnny Eifergen, Daniel Liu, and Danny Yost in studio. Guys, thanks for being here, and we're going to start it right off. Some music live in studio. Here is the track Rube, which is off the new album. It's actually the next single, which will be available tomorrow on streaming sites like Spotify and Apple. Here it is. Rube, take it away, guys.
Ooh, I saw you. Plugged in chambers belong to you. Ooh, in the grocery store, cradled hand as you moved your lips. Stand on ceremony to tear the edge. Oh, my darling Rue, dead from the inside. If I can't have you, this one's for my
Kickback live in studio tonight. The Chicago band will be opening up for Passion Pit at Petrillo Music Shell. Taste of Chicago. How great is it to play Taste of Chicago? We'll get into that. I mean, it's like, I mean, I know that you guys have South Dakota roots, but I mean, you're playing Petrillo. It's kind of a big deal. We'll talk more with the band who are in studio tonight. They got a brand new album coming out, Weddings and Funerals. We'll take a quick break and we'll come back. We'll chat a little with the band and hear some more live music. Stay with us. In studio tonight, the band Kickback, the Kickback, new album coming out, Weddings and Funerals, coming out July 14th. They are going to be opening up for Passion Pit at the Taste of Chicago, Petrillo Music Shell, which is a huge deal, July 8th. They will be, I mean, this is really the start of the touring off of Weddings and Funerals. In studio tonight, Billy Yost, Johnny Eifergen, Daniel Liu, and Danny Yost. Guys, thanks for being here. That was great. Thanks for playing, and we appreciate it.
Thanks for having us back, Justin.
Good to see you. Last time we talked, I mean, it was 2 years ago. It was almost 2 years ago. And you guys have been working on this record. And I was trying to figure out your timeline, Billy, because a lot of what your bio talks about is just sort of your personal relationships and strife and how you wrote the record off of it. And we were just talking in the break that when you were here last time was right when you were going through all the turmoil in your relationship, which is really the source of the music we're hearing now. I didn't know that, so you composed yourself pretty well in September of 2015.
I just remember we tried to do, because Steve Albini had been in the studio earlier that day,
yeah.
Johnny and I tried to throw together a Big Black cover that completely fell apart on air, and I will never forget that as long as I live. And
he probably loved it. Albini probably loved it.
That's comparable to divorce in my eyes, is blowing it in front of Steve Albini. So
how, I mean, when I say that, and it's sort of like, you know, I lightly kind of get into it, but I mean, it is mentioned in your bio and the band's bio. I mean, how important was it for you to write this music based on your relationships?
Divorce, depending on whether or not like you're a real dude or like a guy who's currently wearing cold like gold chains and rocking a sleeveless shirt, you're gonna take that news probably a little harder if you're a sensitive artist type.
So yeah.
I went like full on berserker for about a year, but we were on the road the whole time, so it sort of justifies any of your behavior. But yeah, it was a real rough like year and a half. But I think we were able to make something really cool out of it, which is all you can hope for.
I hate to say it, but I mean, the myth, if it's a myth or it's probably factual, but I mean, the best art is made out of misery. And I mean, how does that play? I mean, the idea of going through this and being in a position where you have the band and the bandmates and the ability to write music, how has that helped you get over sort of a heartbreak?
Well, these guys were real cool about it because I think it was probably a handful to tolerate at the time. But I just like holed up in my friend Ken's basement and just started cranking out demos on his like Mac version of GarageBand. So I had a lot of really good people around, including these guys. And you know, eventually you either pull out of it or you don't. You kind of have two choices. And I'm still working on it, but really, really happy with how the record turned out.
For you, talk about the evolution of as a songwriter, as the music that you're hearing. I mean, beyond just the idea that the music helped you. I mean, what is the sound? What's new in Weddings and Funerals that wasn't in the material you guys were doing before?
Johnny, what do you think?
Jump on that. Yeah,
I think it's more focused, I would say. We're definitely finally starting to find our sound.
We know what we are now. Kinda.
Yeah.
And what is that? I mean, you can hear it. And I hear it, but I mean, you guys have to go on the radio and explain your sound. What is, yeah. I mean, what, when you say you're finally fine, you're focusing, what's the way that you explain the music of the Kickback?
We're still trying to make really like real, like cut some real good hooks about some real depressing stuff. So I like getting depressed people to dance is kind of our, like kind of our goal.
That's great. That's perfect. That's a hook. You just did your marketing. Don't buy a marketing guy. You guys are all set. You just did it yourself.
That's fair.
But I mean, as you guys start to work on the music and you're cranking out demos and you're in a certain place, you know, emotionally, how does the band react? I mean, do you take those demos, you start to put them together, work as a team? How do you collaborate off of Billy's demos that he's cranking out from the basement?
Exactly what we just said. He brings them in. And then we just kind of slowly take them apart and add our influences into them. We all listen to a lot of different stuff, so it really kind of helps change the sound a little bit. But it always ends up just still being, you know, a Kickback song. Yeah, still,
that was like the last tune we just played. You know, Johnny, there wasn't an intro. There wasn't like this cool, jangly intro guitar thing. That's 100% Johnny. Mm-hmm. And that never, you know, that wasn't there in the demo. So it's always awesome to see what these boys can do to stuff.
When you're going for a sound of getting depressed people to dance, and a lot of the music is emotional in nature based on real situations that you all know as band members and being a part of it, mm-hmm. do you feel that emotion if you're not involved in it? So, I mean, I'll ask you, Johnny, I mean, do you feel the emotion even though it wasn't your breakup? I mean, do you understand, I mean, like everything that's going into it, and you try to use the music to, I mean, you respect it with the way that you add to the music?
Yeah, I think so. And funny enough, I actually recently just got married to my wife. So it's kind of like it's weddings and funerals. You know, I definitely understand the thematic elements. We've all been through hardships, you know, over the years, so we get it, and we all just kind of.
I think anybody involved with musicians on any level has a real hard road ahead of them and behind them and currently under them. So
I mean, you guys laugh and joke because it's real. I mean, you guys are on tour all the time. Yeah. I mean, there's a passion, and when you're off tour, you're throwing yourself right back into the music, and probably, you know, that's your sole relationship for the moment. So it is hard to be with musicians.
Yeah, hats off to anybody willing to make that terrible life decision. My heart goes out to you.
You guys have had a tremendous year. I mean, 2 years and since I saw you guys. And it's as you where does that come from, the success? I mean, is it the idea that
divorce?
You guys right, divorce? But beyond the emotional the toll and the relationships falling apart. I mean, it seems to me you guys have found a formula to your success, and a lot of that is surrounds touring. I mean, you guys have been able to put yourself out there and continue to work. Talk about that. Talk about the discipline of staying on the road, because it'd be probably pretty easy to go, all right, let's you know, this is not worth it on this one gig in Philadelphia. Right. But I mean, talk about that's, you know, you're reaping a little bit of the benefits of that by opening up for Passion Pit and getting in front of a lot more of the industry and eyeballs.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're hacking it kind of the old school way, which is staying in the van for like months at a time. And that, depending on how you look at it, is been good for us, or it's been incredibly detrimental. And like, we just picked the van up at 3 o'clock today from Albany Auto from like the third time it's blown up, you know, in a month and a half. So, you know, there are drawbacks and benefits to it, but we just, we all have put our, like, we've, like, as an adult, you kind of hopefully have a plan for yourself when you get out of college or whatever. And ours, I think all of ours was like find some thing you can do to just enable you to be able to make music as much as you possibly can. And when you're on the other side of that and are like, well, I guess this was my plan and it's sort of working out. So yay for being able to make plans.
That's
but
true.
It's another thing when, yeah, you're in a van that broke down just outside Akron. But we just, I don't know, these guys can't really stop and I can't either, so we'll see how long that lasts.
I mean, that's really a big part of it. I mean, there's obviously passion, but then there's also the idea that you can't
like,
stop.
Literally, the van does not have brakes. So
we can't stop.
We cannot stop.
Very literal, the kickback. In studio tonight, the album is Weddings and Funerals. It's out in mid-July. We just heard Rube, which will be dropped tomorrow on Spotify and Apple, those places. The other single, Will T, is already out. They're going to be opening for Passion Pit at the Petrillo Music Shell coming up at the Taste of Chicago on July 8th. We'll take a break. We'll get an update with Roger in the news. We'll come back. We'll hear some more live music. The Kickback in studio. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Thank you, Roger. The Kickback in studio, the guys who were here 2 years ago in September 2015 have a new album coming out, Weddings and Funerals, which will be released in mid-July. The song they just played, Rube, is out tomorrow, pretty soon. I guess, is it a midnight kind of thing? Or are we talking, are you guys pulling like a Use Your Illusion Part 1 and 2, Guns N' Roses kind of thing?
Most of our business decisions are based on Use Your Illusion 1 and 2.
Tomorrow, Rube comes out. Will T is already out. The album out on the 14th. Coming up on the 8th, they're at Taste of Chicago, opening for Passion Pit at the Petrillo Music Shell during... I mean, that's an amazing gig for you guys. We'll talk about that. But let's get some live music. Here is the song False Jeopardy, The Kickback in studio. Take it away, guys.
I found a little false reader enticing. Catching little flicks, sparking a light. Hell, holiday, wouldn't you know? War to water fight, I didn't know. If you start clipping wings, you didn't know about. Then piece by piece, I think you'll find no story ever holding your gaze. Brief crash diet for the salad days. It's not the end, it's not the end, it's false jeopardy. Every little penny made, hollowed out the daylight, I won't be let down. It's not the end, it's not the end. Waiting for a pretty place, get it to mind, and some kind of body to locate at night. Always brings home what you adore. Born for me afterglow, I was unsure. Sure, sure, just try and be sure. It's not the end, it's not the end, it's false jeopardy. Every little penny made hollowed out the daylight. I won't be let down. It's not the end, it's not the end. Just try and be sure. Just try and be sure. It's not the end, it's not the end, it's false jeopardy. Every little bit of man hollowed out the daylight, I won't be let down. It's not the end, it's not the end, it's not the end.
Yes. The Kickback live in studio tonight. The download song False Jeopardy, which will also be on the movie coming out, To the Bone, which will be on Netflix coming up on the 14th. The Kickback in studio tonight. They got their album coming out, which is Weddings and Funerals, on the 14th of July. They also are playing on the 8th, opening up for Passion Pit at the Petrillo. That ding, ding, ding. That's, I think that's the most time.
47.
That's the 47th time I said Petrillo tonight. What's it mean for you guys? I mean, you guys, the press likes to say, you know, that you hail from South Dakota because that's where you're from. But you spent a lot of time here in Chicago.
Yeah, we've been here close to 10 years. So,
what's it mean to play Taste of Chicago, to play a high-profile gig like that?
Johnny, what's it mean?
It's an amazing opportunity. We're extremely grateful, humbled for the chance. We've done Taste of Chicago a couple times, and just to be given this opportunity.
Mean Bud Light stage, it's cool to get... get a little come up and
yeah, the Petrillo. Yeah, the Petrillo. Yeah. Feels good, you know.
And you know, you guys might get an asterisk because, you know, they moved the Blues Fest out of there, they moved the Jazz Fest, they moved that to Millennium Park. Taste of Chicago is probably next. I wouldn't be surprised next year to, like, it's all at the Pritzker Pavilion. Oh, you guys will get the last year of the Petrillo.
I like it. Well, if there's scaffolding, I'm going to climb it. I'm calling it now. Something terrible might happen at the Taste of Chicago. So.
It's probably pretty harsh, the concrete cement, if that doesn't work out, right?
They say it's a little unforgiving. Yeah.
As you guys get more and more accolades and more respect, and you find yourself getting high-profile gigs, like opening up for Passion Pit, I mean, do you changed your sound in the way that your stages get bigger and the audiences get bigger and you're playing outdoor festivals as opposed to small clubs? I mean, does that change the music and how you guys present yourself on stage?
Well, we spent the past couple months touring with 90s alt-rock sensation Bush.
Sure.
Yeah, it was one of those things. But yeah, every night we had to get used really, really fast. We had to get used to playing on some real big stages, so that was really cool. That was a really neat experience.
Yeah, that, I would assume Bush is not playing the Hideout. This is my guess. I don't know. I didn't see.
Playing the Riv was right, real neat. So I mean, we're obviously going back to the way we deserve here on these headliner dates, but it was really neat to kind of learn. Yeah, like you were saying, it's a whole different skill set to work that big of a stage, and it was a lot of fun.
Do you guys, I mean, I've always wondered this about bands, because the hierarchy works, and it looks like you guys are doing the same thing, where you are now getting high-profile gigs opening up for headliners, Passion Pit, like I said, Bush. But, I mean, at a certain point, is, you know, those gigs, I mean, do you approach the gig in a different way as an opening band? You know, when you know you're at Taste of Chicago and there's going to be thousands of people laid out there for Passion Pit, and you know you've got 30 minutes or whatever you get on the stage. Is it less banter? Is it more straight ahead? I mean, do you have a different sort of ethos when it comes to being an opening band for a big band that everybody's there to see?
Yeah, I think it's good to just walk out there with the expectation that somebody's going to hurl something at you. So then everything's just gravy from there. So, like, yeah, we were doing like a 30-minute rock block with Bush. So we got used to me shutting up real quick. and trying to fit in as much music as we could. But we're still kind of talkers and kind of we always come at the audience, I think, a little weird. But that's cool. And we've found that people are way more into the idea of openers than we thought they any than I would be. So it's cool. I like it. It's like that's like pure capitalism, man. You're either going to win them over or you're not. And I really like that. And all other things, I'm not a great at the capitalism game, but in that particular case, I really enjoy
it. You love the business of trying to win somebody over.
Yeah, I'm into that.
Right, you're into that. The Kickback in studio tonight, the album Weddings and Funeral, they're going to be playing at the Taste of Chicago opening up for Passion Pit. That's Billy Yost, Johnny Eifergen, Daniel Liu, and Danny Yost in studio. Here's what we'll do. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get another live track from you guys, if that's cool. Okay. And we'll continue here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman in studio. The band The Kickback, Chicago band, via way of South Dakota. In studio, the brand new album Weddings and Funeral, much anticipated. The single Will T is out. The next single, Rube, is out tomorrow. Spotify, iTunes, those places. The new record, I want to talk about this. So we're going to hear a little music, but Dennis Herring is producer on it, so we'll talk about that. But let's get some new music from The Kickback, who will be at the Taste of Chicago opening up for Passion Pit on July 8th. Here is the last track tonight, live in studio, Reptile Fun. Take it away, guys.
Piling away, planning for the end of better days, leaving too late. What we became, how much decay before I finally throw your toothbrush away. Is that a lie? Ba da 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 da. I got it made, doubling down the pain. I got it made, saving for the fame. Oh, come along this time, and I'll sell everybody lonely. Oh, come along this time, and I'll sell everybody low. Oh, come along this time, and I'll sell everybody lonely. Oh, come along this time, I'll sell everybody low. Just cause it breaks doesn't mean you beat the clock today. Time won't erase, but I'm dead, I'm dead, I'm dead. I got it made, doubling down. I got it made, saving for the fame. Ba, ba, ba. Oh, come along this time, and sell everybody lonely. Oh, come along this time, and sell everybody lonely. Doubling down the pain, I got it made, saving all before the fade. I got it made, doubling down the pain. Well, I got it made, saving for the fade. Oh, come along this time, I'll sell everybody lonely. Oh, come along this time, I'll sell everybody lonely. Oh, come along this time, I'll sell everybody. come along, come along this time. And I sell everybody low.
Yeah! Here we go, the Kickback, live in studio tonight at 720 WGN, right in our Allstate Showcase studio. People's are clapping along outside. They're watching you guys, the Kickback, playing at the Taste of Chicago, coming up, opening up for Passion Pit on the 8th. That's Saturday. They've got the new album, Weddings and Funeral, which is out in mid-July. Two of the singles out. Rube will be out tomorrow. You guys, I mean, the music, it sounds great. And congratulations on all your success, and it's awesome. I feel like connected because this is the second time we've done this together. But
yeah.
but you can feel the evolution of the music, and it really sounds great. And you guys were able. I mean, this is kind of a big deal. I mean, you had a big producer on the last record, on the debut album, but you got Dennis Herring, who's done Modest Mouse and others, to produce on this. And what's that like? I mean, to work with producers with credits.
Yeah. Well. We worked with Jim Eno from the band Spoon on our first album, and that was amazing.
I remember that.
Yeah, Spoon's one of my favorite bands. On this one, I really wanted to work with somebody who definitely had like a point of view coming in. And Dennis has like a real nasty rep, and I don't mean that in a bad good way. Like Dennis has like,
you just mean it in a literal way.
Yeah,
right?
We got told not to work with Dennis from a lot of people because Dennis has a real particular way of working, and it does not work well for a lot of people he's worked with in the
really?
Past. Yeah, and I just wanted to go to war with somebody. Like I was ready. Like I just wanted to make a record that way with somebody who I knew was gonna fight on stuff as much as I was willing to. And it wound up not being that hard. It was still pretty weird. Working with Dennis is weird. It's strange. But I loved it. I think the guys went through as much hell as, probably if not more than I did, making this thing. Because Dennis doesn't care. Like, Dennis just wants the song.
But, I mean, there's something to that.
Yeah.
In the way that, I mean, you're coming to this record with a lot of emotion. We talked at the beginning of the hour about this is really from your breakup with your wife.
Yeah.
You know, there's something to the idea of somebody going, don't care.
Yeah.
His song doesn't work. Yeah. Don't care. I mean, there's something to that conflict.
Yeah. It was hard to, because it would just be like, you know, these verses that are about, you know, literally about your divorce. He's like, yeah, we're cutting that in half. You know, like the story didn't matter as much to him. He wanted what felt right, you know, to him in here. And you got to respect that. For somebody with a record like Dennis. So it was a blast. It wasn't easy, and I don't even know if it was pleasant, but I'm really glad we did.
How often, I mean, you guys, with the touring and working with different producers, I mean, how often do you run into collaborations, whether it be with a sound guy, whether it be with a record producer, whether it be with your own management, that has inherent conflict, not in a bad way, but just a way that it's not necessarily in the vision of the band, and you guys have to, in a way, you have to be problem solved. You have to work around it.
I feel like Johnny confronts that every day of his life. Johnny handles a lot of band business, and I think Johnny's kind of has to be.
Coincidentally, I'm the most. Optimistic guy in the band.
Yeah, it's true. You have to yes and it, right?
So yeah, you just know that after like 100 times of being told no, you're gonna get that one yes. It's gonna be worth the whole experience.
When it's all said and done with the
like when we're dead?
When you're dead, but on July 14th.
Oh, okay.
And you know, the weird relationship you got with Dennis. I mean, when it's all said and done and their album is out, I mean, do you guys feel that the conflict was worth it? I mean, at the end of the day, you're like, that was what we needed as a band.
For me, it was worth it. It's really hard for me to ever hear any of our own stuff. Like, when we're done with it, I don't really ever want to hear it again. But like the last month and a half, I was slamming that record in the back of the van with my headphones on, just feeling like an egomaniac, just feeling like I had totally unchecked ego and it was out of control. But I've never been able to do that my whole life. And that not alone was worth it, but that was like really cool for me.
Yeah, I mean, working with Dennis, I mean, like we came in there with demos that we loved and we already had our parts figured out, but just coming out of it with something that was almost, I mean, it's still at its core the same, but it's not at all at the same time. And Yeah, I mean, I was really proud and happy with it, even though it was rough.
Okay, so now the record's coming out. Here comes another tour. Mm-hmm. How do you guys feel? I mean, you feel, as we sort of, you know, go back to the beginning of this conversation, I mean, this was an emotional experience. You talked a lot about your divorce. You're now going to have to go play all the songs that you wrote about your divorce.
Yeah.
I mean, are you guys prepared for another sort of grueling run on the road?
What do you think, Jay?
Oh, yeah, always. Always prepared.
What do you think, Dan?
Never prepared. We got a lot of laundry to do, man.
A lot of laundry
to
do.
Cancel my Peapod delivery.
Oh, the life of rock and rollers,
yeah.
Right?
Walk your dogs.
That's
I gotta walk my dogs a lot before I leave, so I don't have to do it.
That's right. That's how it works, right? This is the real. This is the real right here. Yeah. The Kickback in studio tonight. The new album, Weddings and Funerals, coming out mid-July. The singles are out, Will T and Rube, which will come out tomorrow. They're going to be playing A Taste of Chicago on July 8th, opening up for Passion Pit. Guys, Billy Yost, Johnny Eifergen, Daniel Liu, and Danny Yost. Where'd Danny go? He's around here somewhere.
He's putting his drums together.
He's just smart. Guys, can't thank you enough for coming back through. I appreciate it. We couldn't, you know, because I know you guys are busy, and it's awesome to have you come back in studio. It means a lot to Pete and to me to have you here, and good luck with the tour, and we can't wait to have you back in studio.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here. Thanks, Justin.
Yeah, thanks so much, everyone. For you to justify my
How do I feel so gross after I hear this song? There's just a gross quality to it. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Tonight, we continue our Thursday night segment in honor of one of the best pastimes in film, identifying the bad ones. That's right. We all love the bad movies, not just the ones that set out to be bad, like parody movies. No, we love the ones that are made in earnest, setting out to be the best film in the history of cinema. And instead, we get face-off. The segment is in conjunction with the series that came from the Neo Futurarium, the long-running summer series that presents stage readings of the best worst movies of all time. This year, it's the 12th anniversary, so it came from the Neo Futurarium, Dawn of the Neo Futurarium. It's running through July 15th, Saturdays at 7:30. I have to ask about Cage. We're going to do that. And, of course, Face Off, which is coming up. We call this segment Justify Your Love. You call up and text your favorite bad movie and justify why it's so bad. And the best bad movie choice will get you a prize. Tonight, a pizza. Come on. So you know it's a bad movie? This, and this is why, and you could have a pizza. Let's have some fun. In studio with me tonight, two of the curators, creator Rachel Claff and Dina Marie Walters. Dina, good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
It's been
Thank
a while.
So
yeah, and you are bringing Face Off to the stage, so I'm very excited about this.
I am. All right. Yes.
All right. Well, Rachel, good to see you.
You, too.
All right. So we've had some fun with this series, and just to sort of explain the rules right at the top.
Right.
So we know what the sort of boundaries or qualifications are for the game.
Yes. So we've seen a lot of bad movies hit our desk. And usually what we end up looking for and what we're looking for tonight are movies, as Justin said, movies that took themselves dead serious at the time. They really thought this was a good idea. Nothing self-consciously bad. Another thing it needs to have is a really, this is more specific to the festival, but it can be specific to this contest, really terrible script. Just awful. It can be as pretty as you want. Explosions.
Right. As you
beautiful
mentioned
cinematography.
Before, the flaw. Everyone has, one of these movies have a flaw.
Yeah, there's
right.
usually a central problem that just makes the whole thing make no sense. Also, it has to be rewatchable. It can't be so bad you just want to pretend you never saw it, burn the
it's
VHS
gotta stick
tape.
Around.
Yeah, it's got to stick around. And finally, it has to be objectively bad. You can't just be like, I hate that. Because as right. Jason Meyer, I think, said the first night, if you hate Anne Hathaway, that doesn't make Princess Diaries a bad film.
Right.
I mean, it could be bad for other reasons, right. but it can't just be, it has to be, there's got to be something just essentially to its core rotten.
There you go. 312-981-7200. We already got some texts coming in tonight. Just to refresh everybody's memory, the first week, we picked Bad Ronald.
Yes, Bad Ronald.
That movie I want to see so
I still can't wait. And, you know, we've already had people directly, at least for me, some of my Facebook friends take direct umbrage with that.
they
really
the
like that movie.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sounds appealing.
Yeah.
And then last week, another movie, Rabbit Test, a late 70s Billy Crystal vehicle in which he becomes pregnant.
Yes.
And it's supposed to be a comedy, but it really doesn't play as a comedy. Mm-hmm. It really is. There's like a lot of moments in there where there's no laughs whatsoever.
Yep.
That one last week. So Rabbit Test and Bad Ronald. Top two picks.
As someone said about Rabbit Test, it had almost the entire cast of Match Game in the movie. Which is a feat in and of itself.
Oh, already a winner. All right, Dina, let's bring you in because you're the movie that you're directing on Saturday, the stage reading that you're bringing in.
Yes, John Woo's Face Off from 1997, which was just released 20 years ago last week.
Oh, well, yep. Congratulations to them.
Right. Happy anniversary.
Now, this is the classic. This is what I love about this because it's a late night. It's a 90s movie, which, you know, we get a lot of set, like either giant rabbits in the 50s or we get 70s movies, but I like the idea that
a
late 90s.
Mm-hmm. Also, peak Travolta, peak Cage.
Mm-hmm.
You yep. can't and, I mean, get really, more.
If you've missed this movie, I mean, it literally is, I'm going to take your face off and I'm going to put another face on. So the actors are playing with
look, it's just aesthetics. Science.
Yeah, of course, it's just science. Yeah, right?
It's all totally believable science.
Highly credible.
How easy is it to put this one on stage?
I want to say it's been challenging only in the most fun ways, and that's in so far as sort of walking through the action sequences. But I think we found some ways to really put a lot of variety into how we. I bought a pair of kids' tugboats for the bath toys. I bought bath toys for the boat chase sequence.
So. Okay, good.
Just as a little
the boat chase sequence.
Yeah,
forgot about that.
We should mention that these are staged readings, and we do it on a shoestring budget.
Right,
so
of course.
The less money, the better.
Which is it has to be that way. If there was actual budget, you'd ruin it.
Yeah,
if well,
you'd
no
almost
money,
be
it,
making
that needs
the,
to
the
be
movie.
The yeah, yeah. Like you should flaunt a bunch of cash in front of the director's face and say, but you can't have it. You can't have it. You have to go with zero. I don't remember much about Face Off, but I have friends who do not put this in the category of worst movie. This is
one of them would be me.
Right. Do you put it on the DVD? You love this movie.
Look, it's terrible, but I love it.
I 100% agree. I love this movie.
Yeah.
I love it. And Justin, you have to revisit
Why do you love it? What makes this movie?
Oh, it
I remember I hated it. I was like, this is so dumb.
Did you really?
Yeah, epic. At the time.
It's absolutely epic. It is, I think the AV Club article that you shared the other day, Rachel, said the overacting Olympics.
Yeah. It is over the top bonkers. Not 1 second of it is not just scenery is being gnawed upon at all times. There's not one person except maybe Margaret Cho who is not going ham in this movie.
Margaret Cho is remarkably understated in this film. I mean, she's...
she's the normal one.
She is the only normal person in this movie.
Well, I mean, all I remember is, the idea that Travolta and Cage, one of one's the bad guy. Travolta's the bad guy?
Well,
Cage is the bad guy.
Cage
see, that's what I mean.
Guy.
Like, I'm like, they're all in black, and they're gonna change their faces off. I'm like, and the poster.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's the other great thing about it is that there is some credible acting going on with the two of them imitating each other. However, at a certain point, it becomes obvious that doing that just means out crazying the other. There, it becomes no delineation between. They're just both going nuts.
It's true. In fact, I would say I've been watching it a lot lately. And Nicolas Cage is so good in this movie. He is excellent.
Yeah, he really is.
He's really, really good. And he's really the star of this film. I feel like Travolta kind of takes a little bit of a backseat to him. Travolta's just really over the top trying to be Cage. You can't out-cage Cage.
You can't out-cage the cage, man.
You can't out-cage the cage.
Here's the thing, too, also, and I don't know if Dina mentioned this, but we are doing this with a bit of a twist.
Uh-oh.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Here's the big reveal.
Okay, I'm ready.
It's completely gender-swapped.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so you had to add that in there, right? It's a gender-swap face-off.
Well, it's rooted entirely in my selfish need to play Nicolas Cage. That's all. And so I felt like I had to justify
it's perfectly
it,
so. Reasonable.
So you're playing Nick Cage. Okay.
I am
so what's
Nick
Cage. I mean, do you, when you, it's stage reading, but I mean, you got to bring some Cage to it. I mean, what do you,
yeah.
She has a little dossier. It's the cutest thing I've ever heard.
So what, I mean, yeah, like what do you have to do to get into a Nick Cage character?
Oh man, just really look deep inside and find your inner crazy is all I have to say.
I would imagine there's a lot of eye widening and grimacing that has to go on.
Yeah, and
limber up your face.
I have little eyes. I mean, I have tiny eyes. So I know at some point I'm going to have to physically open my eyes bigger than they can open to meet the Cage
quota
level.
It's a lot of practice. You get a lot of rehearsal. Dina Marie Walters, she is she's directing. She's also Nicolas Cage in Face Off, which will be on Saturday at the Neo Futurarium up at Foster and Ashland for the Dawn of the Neo-Futurarium stage reading. So the worst plays of all, or worst movies of all time. Rachel Klaff, the creator of the series. All right. 312-981-7200. That's the number. You can text in or you can call. You have to call. It's called Justify Your Love for the Worst Movies of All Time. Give us what it is and tell us why. You can't just text in the name of a movie.
People have been setting the bar pretty high, I have to say.
They have. And people, Download Nation is coming through on this. And there is pizza on the line, folks. 312-981-7200. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Stay with us. That's right. We're justifying your love for the worst bad movies of all time. The best worst, I should say. 312-981-7200. Rachel Klaff and Dina Marie Walters in studio tonight. They are part of the It Came from the Neo Futurarium, Dawn of the Neo Futurarium, the series, the summer series that's running through July 15th. Saturdays at 7:30, presenting stage readings of the best worst movies of all time, right?
Yes.
Face Off is this Saturday, which must see.
Must see.
All right, let's go to the text. We got some people on the line as well, but let's get going. 708 starts us off with Ghost Dad.
Oh man,
Ghost Dad, Bill Ghost Cosby Dad. Joint.
Yeah, so he really tried to bury this film.
He correct. Did for good reason.
Yeah,
he was a star, and he didn't want to come out.
I think it was really panned universally. Was it not?
It was.
Yeah.
Yes, it was.
It's one of those ones where you can't, if you go on like Amazon, the DVD cost $525 and you're like, what?
Why did, I mean.
I don't even think I ever made it to DVD.
Maybe the VHS.
You can only ever get it on, VHS.
Dean, there's a lot of emotion around this. You seem to be putting she has a lot of personal tension. Connection. What's going on? You all right?
When I was growing up, my sister was obsessed with this movie. She was a little kid, and for some reason she found the film absolutely delightful, and she would watch it over and over.
Is it
a,
is it,
and over
is it really what I can't remember the movie. I mean, I know it, I've seen the poster and everything, but is it simplistic as the title says? He's a dad who comes back, he's a ghost dad.
I can't remember how he dies. I feel like it was in a car accident or something, and he becomes a ghost, but he doesn't realize that he's dead. So he comes home, and there's just
a lot of physical comedy,
falling through walls and doors and stuff. And then his kids can see him, and I blocked out chunks of it. At some point, my parents hid the movie, and my sister couldn't find it.
Because she watched it like over and over?
She just watched it so much that my parents, even my brother and I, were like, we can't do this anymore. Please, make it stop. Make the Ghost Dad stop.
That would be a good one to put on stage, Ghost Dad.
I don't know. I think there's just so much surrounding Cosby's name.
Yeah. Right.
But you could do it with like a whole Ghost Dad run and do like that and then Jack Frost.
Oh, Jack Frost.
Although he doesn't become a ghost. He becomes inexplicably a snowman.
But it is in the genre of undead dads.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
That is a genre. I'm surprised you dropped out on iTunes. I'm looking for a movie. What am I looking at?
Undead dads.
Undead dads.
There's also a film called Jack Frost that is not the horror film.
Yeah, and that's horrifying.
Snowman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's dreadful.
It's really bad.
The Jack Frost, there's a couple of kids' movies, and this is where I will draw the line, because there are kids' movies that are just bad.
Oh, yeah.
Like
real
cartoon.
Bad.
I have a 9-year-old.
Weren't
so
you saying you had to see Boss Baby?
I saw Boss Baby twice.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Twice.
And that's
one that you're like, is this just, did they just pull this off the shelf like from eight years ago because Alec Baldwin's kind of big or something? And it just had no reason why it should have been produced.
Yeah.
But I would find that hard to do because it's a cartoon. And My standards are different than my son's standards. He's 9 years old, and he's like, oh, I loved it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is terrible.
Yeah.
Same with the pets. Secret Life of Pets. I did not like that at all. I'm like, all right.
And wasn't there was
dogs.
One that just came out with, I want to say Kevin Spacey voiced one of the.
Yeah, he
there
did
was
a,
another
yeah, he did
a, one that he was did like,
a
why
baby
is this
or
happening?
A yeah. cat or
a cat
something.
Or
like,
a dog or something. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Just awful.
Yeah. I'm going to say something controversial. I watched The Secret Life of Pets.
Yeah.
My daughter's two, and she loved it. I actually really liked it a lot.
No, I didn't like it.
My niece liked it.
Kevin Hart, the rabbit, was just, all right, enough.
Yeah.
Enough. Like, I just got to, but that's, you know, you're a new parent. You will figure it out at
I'm
a certain point.
I'm just starting this journey.
When you get to the, what was the movie?
You'll be fine until she wants to watch Secret Life of Pets over and over.
Or the larynx. Yeah. Was it the Dr. Seuss movie with the
Lorax.
Lorax. Mm-hmm. The larynx.
The larynx.
That's what I'm saying. And wait till you discover the chipmunks.
No, please.
Oh yeah, once you get there. And that's it. That's where Jason Lee went.
Scraping the bottom of the barrel.
That's where he went. That's where you're Jason like, that's where he went. And that's what you'll get when you're watching that movie. Oh, that's where David Cross is at. And it's like, ah.
And all of them, I mean, look, I get that they need to get paid. But, oh boy.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a whole other category as well.
Yeah, I just needed to get paid.
I just needed to get paid. All right, 773 says Staying Alive.
Yep.
The worst best movie, a sequel to Saturday Night Fever that replaces the Bee Gees with Frank Stallone.
It's really terrific. Somebody proposed it and we've got it kind of in our on hold for future.
That's not Travolta? That's
Travolta. No, it's Travolta. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It is?
Yep. And, yeah. He's the same character. Mm-hmm. Is he not?
It's a sequel to Saturday Night Fever.
Oh, okay, right. Fever. Got it. I always wondered about that. I'm like, they seem to be the same, but they're not.
Yep.
It's when
he decides he's
going to become a professional dancer on Broadway.
Yeah, and it culminates with a performance of a show called Satan's Alley.
Oh, yeah.
It's delightful.
What does that mean?
That's
like,
the name
that's the
of
show
the dance.
He's in?
Yeah. Satan's Alley. Wow. Yeah. It's terrific. And it's got that same Saturday Night Fever thing of... Well, okay, there's a lot of dancing and there's John Travolta, but this movie is really sexist and horrible. Just really uncomfortable. Yeah.
All right. Here's one for you. I've never heard this one. I hope. All right. I think they love this one. 847 says, I love Summer Magic, a Disney film from the early 60s.
Ooh.
Saccharine sweet, set in the early 1900s.
Okay.
With Burl Ives singing Ugly Bug Ball. It still makes me feel like everything will turn out right.
Oh, God bless
you. And what's wrong with that?
Nothing.
But then my favorite line of the text is, but not a great movie by any standard.
But not a great movie. Yeah. I wonder if it's animated.
Maybe.
Who knows? We'll have to look it up.
Summer Magic. We'll look that one up.
Summer Magic.
All right, let's keep going here. 773 says, bad movie, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. We had that one.
We did, and that, I think we figured out, was more of a parody movie.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a little too self-aware.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there was the attack of, there was the rabbit one that we were talking about.
Oh, Night of the Lepus. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that weren't self-aware. They were going for an actual thing.
They were, and you know, you could argue that they're sort of Z-grade horror that you're scraping the bottom of, like, what can we be afraid of this time? I don't know, bunnies! And I think that's what Tomatoes is going for, which is we've exhausted everything we can possibly be afraid of. Let's do something outlandish and make them kill our
tomatoes. So that fits into more of like a tongue-in-cheek parody kind of thing.
I think so,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I figured out that Tomatoes 2, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes 2, is the one that George Clooney is in. He's not in the first one, but he's in the second.
Did not know there was a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there you go. You learn something new every night here.
There's always a sequel.
I say it on the show too, one of my weak points is that, you know, I come from a generation of people just gobble up movies, and I skipped them. I don't know what it is. I was always like, man, so I hear all these movies, and I don't have a frame of reference.
You and me both,
but...
man. I missed a huge chunk, not because I missed them, but because my sister was afraid of everything. And we could not go to a movie theater without being yanked out. So I missed a humongous chunk of movies that aren't that scary, but my sister couldn't do it.
I feel like I saw a lot of the movies when I was a kid. It was when I got to like high school, college. And I was just like, I'm going to play my acoustic guitar. I'm going to hang out at the party. We're just going to skip the movies. It's like when everyone started going crazy for Reservoir Dogs. That's where I was like, I got to go.
Yeah. Well, you also had no money in college. And so unless it was playing at your local, you know, cinema with a student discount, you didn't get to see. I went to college in Ohio and we had to go all the way to Cleveland to see Pulp Fiction. And I remember that being an outing, you know. But otherwise, we didn't get to see a lot.
All right, let's try one. Right before we go to break, let's go to Pete. Pete, you're on the line. What do you got for justify your love for the worst movies of
all
time?
I think this could get the Ed Wood Award.
Okay.
It's a thing that starred David Carradine titled The Warrior and the Sorceress.
Oh, I think I know this movie.
Me too.
Yep. Yeah,
the poster gives it all away. I mean, it was when they had the ads in the paper, it was so awful I had to go see it in the theater. David Carradine in a pose where he's about to slice the head off of a big monster serpent that he's strangling in one hand with a sword he's got in the other. From the neck up, it's Carradine. From the neck down, it's Schwarzenegger. And there is a female form laying across at his feet, but it's not the sorceress. I think the sorceress was actually Sophia Braga.
Okay.
This is early. I mean, this was done down in Central America.
On the cheap.
Oh, this was awful.
Oh, man, good stuff.
I mean, everything about it was atrocious. The monsters, you could see, there's a serpent thing that has... like an octopusy thing that has a whole bunch of tentacles that come up out of holes in the floor, and you can see all the nylon lines.
That's when you know it's a good movie.
Uh-huh.
All right, thanks, Pete.
Oh, it's awful. Find the poster out at IMDb. You'll laugh.
Poster
alone.
That's
always good when you get the posters. Thanks, Pete. All right, 312-981-7200. We are judging the best worst movies of all time. And I think we got some good starting. I got a lot of texts that are just coming in right now, including some calls. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll get Roger's news. We'll come back for the second half of Justify Your Love for the best worst movies of all time. Stay with us. For you to justify my love.
I can't help but giggle on still this dumb song.
It makes me think of the Wayne's World parody on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, yeah, with Madonna.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where they're all in the bed.
Yeah, there was like the sex book she did. It's a download here on 720 WGN. We are justifying your love for the best, worst movies of all time. Rachel Claff and Dina Marie Walters in studio. They are curators. Rachel, the creator of It Came from the Neo-Futurarium, which is stage readings of the best, worst movies of all time. You can see them running on Saturday nights through July 15th, 7:30 this week. Dina Marie, her star turn as Nicolas Cage in Face Off.
I should mention that in 2009, she did a tour de force performance as Vanilla Ice in Cool as Ice.
Amazing.
And this is just the natural extension of that.
I did not see it, but just the choice of that movie.
The commitment level alone.
Did you honor the triangles, the weird symmetrical sets that were in that movie?
There were definitely descriptions of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There were like, were there descriptions in the script for what the supposed, because there was this weird thing in that movie where
Rebel Without a Cause, and then all of a sudden it becomes Pee Wee's Playhouse.
It became like contemporary art in the middle of this supposed to be this sleepy town that the motorcycle gang stops.
Yeah.
That film is bonkers.
It's so good.
Beautiful. And so we figured out halfway through staging it that the cinematographer is Janusz Kaminski.
What?
Yeah. Who, you know, now is Steven Spielberg's go-to guy. It probably an early Cool as, you know.
But, no, it's probably late.
But it makes a lot of sense,
didn't
right?
He do, didn't Janusz Kaminski do Schindler's List?
Yeah, but that's long after.
Is that long? How long?
Well, not long after. I'm going to say 94.
Cool as Ice was in 1991.
Yeah.
And I believe Janusz Kaminski was also a Columbia College grad.
No way.
Yeah, I could be wrong on that, but I know it's one of Spielberg's
guys.
Which,
you know, so you look at it and go, okay, well, that makes sense. It is an awfully attractive movie to look at.
I mean, Michael Gross as a dad, as the mean dad, is so good. All right, here we go. Tony, you're on the line. What do you want to, what justify your love for the best, worst movie of all time?
I'd have to go with Kiss meets the Phantom of the Amusement Park.
Yes, sir. We staged it twice, in fact. We did it one year and then, with a full band on stage playing the Kiss songs.
It was awesome.
It was beautiful. That movie makes no sense.
And the band was in full Kiss makeup.
Yep.
What makes
about the other one with Gene Simmons and Tom Selleck and Kirstie Alley?
What are you talking about?
Yeah, we're interested. Is Is Gene Simmons still as a member of KISS, or is he, is this where he's just more of a character actor?
Yeah, he's the main evil character in the entire movie, just as himself. And that's, he thought that was going to launch his career because
wow.
he was with Tom Selleck, and then Kirstie Alley's his girlfriend, and the other big actress was, I forgot her name. She was married to Richard Marx.
I just looked it up. The movie is Runaway.
Runaway.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
that sounds awesome.
Cynthia Rhodes, Kirstie Alley, Gene Simmons, Tom Selleck. Written and directed by Michael Crichton.
Wow.
Oh.
Wow.
Crichton getting in the game. All right. Good for him. All right. Thanks, Tony. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Those are good choices there. All right. Let's keep going. We got a lot of stuff coming in through. And 708 said the movie is Runaway, yes. All right. Here we go. Let's start with 847 says the cook, the thief, his wife, and her lover.
Yeah. Peter Greenaway film. Now, this is widely considered a pretty decent art house film. I personally gave up after the first 20 minutes.
But it's an art film.
It's an art film. So either you can't do it, or you can't.
It breaks the law or the rules on the game that couldn't stomach it. You're like, you're not coming back to watch it
just because you don't like it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's not one that you're going to rewatch over and over and over.
As I recall, it's pretty violent. So I don't think, in its weird way. So I don't think you can. Yeah. It's not the one you want to watch again.
Let's go. 773. He's got Tiptoes with Matthew McConaughey and Gary Oldman as a dwarf is a pretty famous, insanely poorly conceived movie.
Okay. Here's the scenario. First of all, we did this movie and it was one of my favorites because all I did the whole night was to watch the audience watch the movie and the jaws dropped were, it was so.
What's it about?
Okay. So here's the premise.
and I should interject here and say, if you can, drop everything.
Yeah.
And just watch the trailer. And you're going to say to yourself, this cannot be real.
Correct. Matthew McConaughey is dating Kate Beckinsale. They are, I think, engaged to be married at the start of the film. What Kate Beckinsale doesn't know is that Matthew McConaughey has a twin, Gary Oldman, who is a little person.
Okay.
Gary Oldman plays said little person on his knees throughout the film with his arms sort of pulled back. And now you have to remember, he's playing the lead of this movie, but also in the movie are people like Peter Dinklage and Michael Anderson, famous little people actors playing little people, and yet the star of the movie is Gary Oldman.
It's all sorts
of
wrong.
Yeah, so they get married and have a baby, and turns out that the baby is a little person. Now, here's what, we were talking about the central flaw thing. That is not possible scientifically because dwarfism is passed on through...
You did your research on this.
I've heard that this is true, that it's not passed on through the father's side. It's passed on through the mother's side. It is technically impossible that their child was a little person.
You could just suspend a little bit disbelief.
Unless
movie,
Kate Beckinsale had little people in her.
Right.
So then there's just all kinds of shenanigans ensue. Matthew McConaughey is devastated by this news, and it is supposed to be a serious drama.
I mean,
like a morality tale about...
They are
all super serious
on this film.
Yeah.
Everyone is just acting so hard.
It is amazing. And the lines in the movie, you go, wait, did somebody just say that? It's extraordinary. Noelle Krim, who directed it, pitched it to me, and I promptly said, well, that's not real. She said, no, go look it up. I said, okay.
773 just texts in, drop everything, watch the trailer.
No, it's incredible. Yeah.
My favorite moment in the trailer is when the voiceover says, and Gary Oldman in the role of a lifetime.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're like, that's one
I should also point out, this just layers upon layers. Peter Dinklage plays a French anarchist.
Oh, yeah.
Who is dating Patricia Arquette.
Oh, man. I mean, there are actors in this
film. Real actors. David Alan Grier is in it for no reason.
And what's amazing is everyone looked at the script and said,
It also went to Sundance. It was a Sundance thing. I think they really thought that it, and there's a rumor floating around somewhere that there's a longer director's cut that's good, quote unquote. I can't, you cannot convince me of that.
All right. Wow. My face hurts from smiling. All right, let's keep going. 630 says the worst movie that they've ever seen was called Kid with C. Thomas Howell.
Okay.
And Tank with James Garner.
Huh.
So bad they're entertaining.
C. Thomas Howell was a big heartthrob in the 80s.
I'm assuming this is an 80s film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kid, I don't know.
Because he was also in The Outsiders.
And Tank. Tank was one of those that, yeah, Tank is
I don't
is
know
dumb.
Tank.
It's dumb.
Okay.
I think he's mad at the government.
See, Thomas Howell is mad at
no,
the government?
No, James Garner.
James Garner.
Oh, James Garner.
And I think I'm trying to remember because it's an 80s film too. And
1984.
And he like gets a tank. And it becomes like, it's kind of like, we're having fun. Like it's okay. Garner like in a smiley kind of comedy kind of way.
Huh.
But he's like got a tank. I forgot how it plays out.
I don't know. They're just you describing
it
is very.
Kind of,
it's a tank.
It's a tank out of water
film.
Story. Yeah. When tanks were really in, we're all obsessed with tanks.
Sure.
Oh,
C. Thomas Howell was also in one of the worst movies ever made, Soul Man.
Yeah, that is. How did that even get made? But
I don't
that
know.
Film.
Yeah.
Is
it's appalling.
Yes.
All right, 312-981-7200. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We got a lot more, and I want to go through them, and get because there's some really good stuff here, and I want to make sure we get them all on, and then we will pick this week's winner. We are justifying your love for the best worst movies of all time. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. Rachel Klaff, Dina Marie Walters in studio tonight. They are part of the Neo Futurarium. It came from the Neo Futurarium, the stage readings of the worst plays of all time, or worst movies of all time. On stage at the Neo Futurarium, Foster and Ashland on Saturdays at 7:30. The next one coming up here, Face Off.
Can't wait.
Where Dina Marie gets to play Nicolas Cage.
Yes, I want to take his face off.
So good. Which was ad-libbed, apparently, that
yes.
line.
Yes, that was ad-libbed. So was the line when John Travolta says, when he talks about this ridiculous chin. That was also.
I like that we couldn't rely on the fact that the movie was called Face Off. Nicolas Cage actually had to say it.
Yeah, he has to say it.
Yeah.
But he says it in such a way.
Yeah.
Face.
The perfect way.
Right. Let's go to Brian. Brian, what do you got for the best worst movie of all time?
Hi, everybody. Good evening.
Good evening.
Hello.
Hey, I just was telling your producer what you said. My wife and I watched this the other day. I couldn't believe Dirty Grandpa with Robert De Niro. And,
oh, my.
That handsome young lad that my daughters and stepdaughters are crazy about.
Zac Efron.
Dirty Grandpa.
Mm-hmm. It's recent. It's really recent, right?
Yeah, like the last 2 years.
I've tried on several occasions to get my wife to go, let's watch Dirty Grandpa, and it never happened. So I guess she was right.
I couldn't believe how embarrassing it was for him. I mean, I was telling your guy, with The Godfather and Raging Bull and Casino, I mean, how he's lowered his standards. It was beyond belief.
That's been a long slide coming, though,
yeah,
man.
Meet the Fockers
yeah.
goes in that direction.
Yeah. Anger management.
It's really sad. Really sad. I guess he needed the paycheck or, I don't know, something going on with him. But
yeah.
My wife and I said, I can't. We couldn't believe what I said. We're watching this. We had to turn it off about halfway through. It was so bad.
Oh, well, see, that kind of disqualifies it.
A little
because
bit.
The idea is you got to watch and be like, that was so bad, we got to watch
we
it
gotta
again.
We got to watch it again. Yeah.
So this one gets shut off halfway through. All right, thanks, Brian. Thanks, Brian. All right, let's keep going. Great movie. I'm not sure what it's about. Okay, 815. Worst movie, new National Lampoon Vacation.
Those are just unwatchable bad.
That's unwatchable.
Yeah,
that falls in the
so.
Same category as Dirty Grandpa. The idea of a remake where you're like, this is just a one-star movie.
Yeah. Just not any fun.
Right. All right. Let's get to some other ones here. Someone says, how about The Loved Ones, a twist on Undertakers and their business? I don't know that one.
I don't know that either.
We did figure out that Kid is a movie that C. Thomas Howell was in.
Yes. As well as Tank.
Yeah.
C. Thomas
he was
Howell
in both.
Was
in both. Yeah,
somebody has a little bit of a C. Thomas Howell fetish.
Yeah. Well, always good, though, right? Always good. All right. Let's keep going here. Grease 2, we had that one.
That's really bad.
That was bad. And we spent a good amount of time on Grease 2 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, it was may have been off air, but yes, we did discuss the
badness
of Grease 2.
I remember, because we were like trying to figure out who played
Yeah, sure, the people
characters.
Who came back versus, yep.
708 says, best worst movie of all time, Fish Called Wanda. I don't agree with that one.
No, that's
I
a wonderful movie.
Yeah, that's okay.
That's a classic.
630 also goes in that direction with Moana, the new Walt Disney movie.
I also disagree.
I can't. Yeah.
But 630 also says have fallen asleep watching it twice, still haven't seen all of it, so that falls into that category once
that's
again.
That's the personal distaste for
right,
a movie.
Right.
Plus that movie, oh man, so good.
All right, and then 708's got a good one. Batman and Robin with George Clooney.
Yep.
Oh, costumes were horrible with nipples showing.
The Schumacher era.
Yeah. Arnold Schwarzenegger and Uma Thurman as the villains.
Yes.
Alicia Silverstone as Batgirl.
Mm-hmm. A lot of ice cold puns.
A lot of
right?
freezy puns.
Oh my God.
That puns. Might be Schwarzenegger's worst role of all time. He's terrible in that movie. And that's saying a lot, right?
I don't know, man. You've got Junior. Yeah. You've got Hercules in New York.
One. Junior's the one where he's pregnant, right?
Yes.
Junior's the one where he's pregnant. You've got twins. You've got, what's the
tumor,
one? What's the one where he's trying to get the toy for his son? The heck is that movie called?
It's Christmas. It's got
it's a Christmas movie.
Title.
Terrible.
Tom Arnold is in it, right?
Yeah. Really just a slew of terrible Schwarzenegger movies.
630 says Roller Boogie.
Oh, Jingle All the Way.
Jingle All the Way. There it is.
Roller Boogie.
We did that one.
We talked
about
that.
Hercules with Lou Ferrigno. At one point when Hercules throws the bear to the stars, it's quite obviously a teddy bear on a fishing line.
That sounds like one of our stage readings.
It really does. It really does. Right? It sounds like something we'd do.
And then I wanted to read the one. I want to get down to because it was right at the beginning. I love this one. The movie is Waterworld.
Oh, right.
Yeah, which is a strong one.
Horrible.
And I need to find the explanation because it's so good.
I always threatened to stage Waterworld. What I really wanted to do was stage a bunch of water-themed movies all up and down the coast, like the beaches of Chicago.
Oh, yeah, right. There you
in
go.
Like some of the, you know, like the park district buildings and stuff and just do all water world, all water
I love
movies.
It. That yeah. would be a good one to do. Waterworld, Flaw,
right.
once again.
And then like Poseidon Adventure, you could do all kinds of
all right, here's 224. 224 says, here's a funny story regarding seeing it with my ex-husband. We sat down in the dark. We missed the previews. Movie already started. We watched an hour and I whispered how awful it was and how dark the coloring of all the screens were. He turned and looked at me laughing hard. Bonnie, you still have your sunglasses on. We laughed for a half hour. It did not improve Waterworld. Right there without sunglasses.
Love that.
That's pretty good. Waterworld has to, yeah.
This is terrible, and it's so dark.
Right. 773 says it is Jingle All the Way.
Yep.
And the central message is that Christmas is really about buying toys.
Correct.
And then also Batman and Robin's best quality is that the only big screen adaptation of Adam West.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's the only one. The other ones have not. They were all kind of their own thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
773 says Barbarella.
Yep, that's awful. It's like good. That's a cult following bad movie with Jane Fonda.
Yeah,
I remember being oddly terrified by that movie because there's a scene where these creepy dolls. I don't remember. It's been a long time, but it was really
creepy.
Creepy
doll.
Yeah,
always about the creepy doll.
Yeah.
The last one tonight, 708, Tank Girl with Lori Perry.
Oh
gosh,
I've
only seen that movie once.
Here's the thing. It's one of the first, I think, anyway, live action movies that's really going for a comic strip. So it's got a lot of that, you know, stuff
it's
that
trying something different, but not really.
Well, I mean, I don't mind it. I think it's kind of fun. I think movies that did it better are like Scott Pilgrim, you know, where you get that kind of, oh my gosh, this is really a comic strip come to life.
Right.
I liked it. Lori Petty didn't do a lot after that, but she's fun. I think it's fun. It's definitely silly.
The last one here and I feel like this is really good and it's not going to probably make it to the list tonight, but 630 Rhinestone.
Rhinestone.
Oh my gosh.
Sylvester Stallone.
So good.
Oh man.
I feel like that one needs to the cutoff has already happened and that could be one for next week cuz that's so he's a country singer in that, right?
He's a taxi driver who Dolly Parton's
in it. She's a country singer.
She is in some kind of bet where she has to make him into a country singer by the end of the film. She does.
Because there's a weird thing with the hips and the jeans. Uh-huh. That's all I remember. Like hips and jeans.
The movie would like you to think that she succeeds. The movie would be wrong.
All right. We're giving away a pizza tonight. A Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Oh, Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations. Order online at loumalnati's.com. All right. Dina Marie Walters, Rachel Claff, it came from the Neo Futurarium. Go see Face Off this Saturday at the Neo Futurarium at Foster and Ashland.
So many plastic doves.
Oh,
yeah. I bought a lot of feathers, a lot of doves.
Oh, this is going to be so good. All right, tonight, so we've got some, we break it down right here. Warrior and the Sorceress,
mm-hmm.
Ghost Dad, Batman and Robin,
yep,
or Tiptoes.
I mean, I'm biased, but Tiptoes, yeah. Man.
It sounds like, I haven't seen it, but what you explained,
yeah.
Tiptoes fits into
it's
the...
It's got that thing where you go, how is that possibly a movie? And then when you watch it, it far surpasses your expectations.
And it's earnest.
So earnest.
Yeah.
What do you think, Dean Marie?
Oh, I agree with Rachel. It is, it just completely encapsulates
yeah.
our aesthetic, our...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's genuinely the number one, like, you want the pinnacle of took itself seriously.
Yeah.
Boy, that's it.
All right. Tiptoes is the winner tonight.
Woo-hoo!
How about
Yay!
That? All right. Rachel, Dina, Marie, thanks so much for being here.
Oh,
and
thank you.
Good
so
luck with the good luck with Face Off. That's going to be awesome.
So
I can't
much.
Wait to hear how it goes.
Can't
thank
wait.
You.
That's going to do it tonight for The Download. Patty Vasquez up next. Bridget Gaynor joins us tomorrow night, the Cook County Board Commissioner. We'll talk with her. We'll also reload this week's news with Amara Enya and Mario Smith. Got a lot going on. Patty, good to see you.
What's going on? Is there anything going on? What are you talking about?
I know, right?
Okay.
Nothing. Just a breezy, breezy pre-holiday weekend, right?
Oh, man. The state's not going to be fixed by tomorrow night. Just going to tell you that
you
deadline.
You don't think so?
No. I actually just got off the phone with several legislators who say they're going to go into July. But that there is movement to have a kind of a maybe perhaps a lifeline budget again. But there are legislators who don't want to vote on that because that's how we keep getting back here at the end of June.
Would that be enough to sort of ward off the credit agencies?
That's the problem.
Yeah.
It would not.
They're not going to be like, oh, we'll take your word for it.
Yeah, since right. you guys are you know, yeah. finding a way oh, to yeah. make sure the roads right. still are worked on and schools open and things like that. No. Anyway, so we'll talk to Representative Sarah Feigenholtz.
Oh, great.
She's actually optimistic, so that's what we need. We need someone who is in there fighting a good fight, as many of them are. And then we have Scott Stantis, who I'm sure has some thoughts on the whole thing.
Great.
And David Hochberg is going to be
nice.
Our Thrifty
David,
Thursday. Yeah,
yeah.
He's right. He kind of kills you with his kindness.
I guess it's the worst thing you can say about somebody.
Right, kills you with kindness.
And yeah, that's good, though,
right? Hostile kindness is what I call it. So have a great. Right. Are you off tomorrow? Are you working?
No, I'm in tomorrow night.
I'll be in Springfield. So.
All right, that's a great place to be on the last day.